Good evening, everyone, or good morning, or good afternoon, whichever the case may be around this rotating globe. Welcome to another edition, live, of The Other Side of Midnight, that magical time between dusk and dawn where we watch the passing parade and try to make appropriate salient comments. And sometimes it's very, very hard. Well, tonight we have a very almost a milestone show or a benchmark or any of the other significators that I used with George Wednesday night when I was doing a couple of hours on Coast. Because what I tried to do is to preview for all our new listeners here at The Other Side of Midnight who came over from Coast to see what it is that we're doing. Well, what we're doing tonight is we're doing part two of what we did a few weeks ago, a show we called A Piece of the Action, which is a title mercilessly stolen from Star Trek, original, you know, first season, because there was an episode. Well, we'll get into that when we get into that, because it deserves a whole kind of backdrop to see how incredibly appropriate that meshing of titles truly is. However, before we do that, let me get to a couple of news items. One of the reasons why tonight's show is so important is because we're literally at the edge of a precipice. I don't know how carefully you guys have been watching what's going on in Eastern Europe or in the Middle East, but we are very perilously close to something that's unthinkable that I haven't frankly thought of for decades when I was doing the duck and cover in class under our desks, which even at the time seemed kind of silly. And believe me, at those times when you were just a kid in school and they wanted you to survive a nuclear blast by ducking under your desk, you didn't really make any comments like, is this really going to do anything? The teachers and the faculty and the school did not like the idea that what they were doing was, even to us 10-year-olds, really dumb. You know, if you'd seen any television and see what a nuclear weapon could do, the idea that you could duck under your desk and be fine was, anyway, that's the world we lived in. And I have not felt that extraordinary existential reality until relatively recently with this insane war in Ukraine and the head of the former Soviet Union, now called Russia, but really harking back to its past, a guy named Putin, who every 3 or 4 weeks raises the specter that he's going to unleash nuclear war on somebody like us. The only thing that I think can change this, and I'm not sure that even it's big enough, we can somehow collectively bring the reality of the solar system, of the extraterrestrial presence, both ancient and contemporary, to the foreground so that the world realizes that we have so many more interesting and extraordinary things to do but engage in a final conflict, a thermonuclear exchange, which is the way they, euphemistically put it back in the 50s and 60s, a thermonuclear exchange. Well, that really does kind of cover up what's going on, doesn't it? Anyway, I have felt for many, many years, decades really, that if this planet was going to change and dramatically so it would save us and save itself, it had to be in the face of something so staggeringly large that it would affect every single human being on the planet when it became known. And I don't know of anything bigger than the reality of other folks out there who are kind of looking at what's going on down here. And frankly, if I were them, I'd be wondering, are they going to make it? And there apparently are strict rules about interference, prime directive maybe. Is that where Gene got the idea? But on the moon, we have a totally different situation because we're not dealing with UFOs or UAPs or what other acronym the government tries to foist off on us, hoping we'll forget how long and ancient these observations have been going on. So in the last couple of weeks, there was a report published by Pentagon, the Arrow Office, the Office of Anomalies. Is that a redundancy? Yes, it is. Anomalous Anomalies. And basically, this report says, nothing to see here. Move along, move along. It's all just tricks of light and shadow and a few misidentifications, and there are no ETs. There are no spacecraft. There is no interstellar, you know, confederation. There's no galaxy that's filled with other sentient beings. We're all by our lonesome, period, end of discussion. And I know I tried last Sunday to bring Stephen on, Steve Bassett, to give us the current inside read as to what's really going on. And between him and me, my illness and his problem of being at a conference when he agreed to do this, we have to reschedule Stephen's appearance with an update on what's going on at the Pentagon in terms of UFOs, because the report is not exactly, I have said from the get-go, from the beginning, that this extraterrestrial highway had two off-ramps. One was the UFO crowd, you know, things that go bump in the night, distant specks of light, you know, possible interaction of beings with average people in the middle of nowhere, which has been going on for decade after decade. And no one, you know, there's this collective body of folklore around UFOs, and then there's the response of the real world, the mainstream world, which changed dramatically in December of 2017, because that's when the New York Times decided to begin to take a serious interest. Now, is this all being orchestrated to come up to a big, oh, there's nothing there, move along, which is what the Pentagon report basically said? Or what happens if we go in the other doorway, what I call the artifacts doorway? Because completely unacknowledged by NASA, by the U.S. government, by any other governments with any other space programs on the planet, is the fact that now, based on decades of discovery and analysis of imagery and other readings from a multitude of unmanned spacecraft, which have fanned out from many nations all across the solar system, I can say tonight with great confidence that we are surrounded by our ancient, ancient interstellar history, which somebody obviously does not want us to know about. Therefore, the cover-up report from the Pentagon basically saying, bottom line, nothing to see here, move along, move along, move along. That's why the other potential for breaking this stalemate wide open is still on the table. It's the artifacts. It's the ruins. It's things built, which we can verify with really amazing imagery. And in the third hour, we're going to surprise you with something that's really pretty shocking and amazing that's just been discovered. And not by us, but by one of our colleagues. Ruggiero Kahlo is going to come on, and we're going to talk to him about what he has discovered in a place that even I had to look twice to take it seriously. That's how preconditioned our reactions are by authorities who basically sit in offices with computers and decide, without input from anybody else, what the reality is in the solar system, not just those things that potentially could be visiting the Earth, i.e. manned or person vehicles. Because the other doorway that I have held for decades is potentially the breakthrough, is what I call the artifacts doorway. At what point does enough imagery from enough different nations scattering spacecraft around the solar system, reporting back amazing imagery, again, of artifacts and ruins and intelligently designed machines. At what point does this extraordinary in-house database, both in the Russian space program, in the Japanese program, in the Chinese program, in the U.S. program, in the ESA program, that's the Europeans, In other words, everybody has sent spacecraft taking pictures of things all over the system that we have now analyzed, and there is nary a world that does not show some evidence of some kind of artificial alteration. And that has been the status quo for the last decade, 2 decades, 5 decades, half a century since NASA was born, because obviously there are two separate space programs. There's the one that we get a chance to look at, where there's basically nothing but rocks and craters and radiation out there. Then there's the other one, the real one, the so-called hidden mission, which I stole freely from Keith Laning, because that seems to be the two tracks on which NASA's funding has been expended. The public sector, looking at science, looking at radiation, looking at craters, looking at atmospheres, looking at gullies and water. And did I mention craters? Yes, of course I did. And then there's the real program, which of course is looking at artifacts, and we never get to see, except kind of accidentally or deliberately on the sly, to see how many people are paying attention. I mean, I really think a lot of this has to do with a PSYOPS program to measure how smart and bright people are before they finally get that they're surrounded by evidence of an ancient history of humanity, which is staggering in its longevity, in its capabilities. And if we rediscover it, if we reunite with our own heritage, with the incredible treasures and benefits to humankind, if they just lighten up and let us know what's out. Andrew Curry and I have been working on a kind of a model which has drawn a lot from that particular Star Trek episode, A Piece of the Action. And so we're going to describe tonight additional reasons why disclosure of what's surrounding us should have happened day before yesterday, and not wait until collectively, politically, our will, the will of all those people who have come over from George's show on Wednesday night to kind of see what we've got and whether we've got the goods. Believe me, we've got the goods, as you're going to see in the next 3 hours. Whether that's going to make any difference, because somehow there must be a connection between the body politic and their perception of reality and those of the overseers, those of the folks who are in charge, even in a so-called democratic society. It's amazing how we have infinite coverage of things that only one or two people or maybe family, I'm thinking of the Princess of Wales, and we have zero coverage of the stunning breakthrough mission to the moon by the mainstream a couple weeks ago, the Odysseus mission, sent by private corporation from U.S. soil, Intuitive Machines, based in Houston. And it's from that unmanned mission that we are going to be drawing a tremendous amount of information tonight to lay as a backdrop to the things that are going on planet Earth that desperately need an intervention. My item number one in Radio with Pictures, for those of you who are new to The Other Side of Midnight, you want to click on our banner, which says very dramatically, A Piece of the Action, Part 2, the plan to steal the hidden treasures of the moon. And that seems to be kind of going on. And to me, it's such an insight as to the overwhelming layers of skullduggery and deception and outright lies and disinformation about what's out there, what lies all around us in the solar system. And as we move through the program this morning, you're going to see that Andrew and I are putting together an alternative model, which, again, like any model, should have some predictions so you can test it and see if it works, as to why this decades and decades long cover-up of what's around us, you know, forget UFOs, forget ETs, forget guys in little spaceships, just look at the archaeology on nearby planets, beginning with the moon. Now, of course, you can't openly do that because the authority figures are saying that we're nuts and there's nothing out there and, you know, we're just kind of crazy. Well, they've been saying it for 28 years, And we'll get into why that 28 years is interesting in the next few minutes. So let me direct you to how to get to tonight's pages. See that banner, which says a piece of the action. Click on that. That will take you to the Radio with Pictures page, where you can actually see, if I can get the right thing here, the images and the news items that we have arranged for tonight. The backdrop against which all this is playing out is the idea that we're teeter-tottering on the brink of something so horrendous, so awful, that most people can't even think about it. And the only thing big enough to change it, as I said a few moments ago, I think is the reality the human race is not carrying out this stupid set of soap operas here all by our lonesome, but there are lots and lots of observers and some entities which are interfering and interacting. And this is all going on against this backdrop of a formerly inhabited solar system with millions of square miles of architecture that all we have to do is look and we'll see what's there. And then, of course, we need to send missions to find the libraries. Because the libraries, either on the moon, Mars, or in the asteroid belt, maybe on Mercury, whoever, wherever they are beyond the Earth, they will be found. The reason is that if they were there in the first place, somebody wanted descendants, us in this case, to find them. So they should come with some kind of marker, provided you have an open observation and analysis of what the images taken by all these separate space programs are telling their respective governments, which, of course, they're not telling us, because we're not the only ones that know what's out there. And we'll go through a litany of who else could probably know based on their missions as the morning or the evening, wherever you are, proceeds. So my first item, this was something that came up this week. This is the first time the U.S. has now introduced a resolution at the United Nations calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza with a release of all the hostages. We have vetoed previous efforts in this direction for reasons that are obviously not too hard to figure out, because with Netanyahu at the controls in Israel, dealing with him is not easy, not at all. And our efforts have been obviously trying some kind of a diplomatic, you know, do-si-do, where we can encourage and ameliorate certain tendencies and move the Israelis in a more appropriate direction with their constant, incredible, mind-numbing bombardment of Gaza. I mean, can you imagine 2 million people literally because of the actions of the Israelis and cutting off food and water and gasoline and everything else? You're going to have millions of people dying, if not in days, and then in weeks, unless something radical changes. And as you see from the headline, when the U.S. introduced this resolution after vetoing probably 3 or 4 before, China and Russia vetoed ours. So we're at a standoff in the only body in the international community which has a prayer of getting something changed in this horrible situation in the Middle East, where we're looking, I mean, we're really looking at genocide. And I say that as a supporter of Israel, because the current government of Israel is acting so counter to everything that Israel was founded not to do, turn around and do the same thing to somebody else that was done to it, or the occupants, the citizens of Israel, going back many, many, many decades. So again, stalemate. The only thing I think is big enough to change this is coming face to face with the reality that the human race is not alone. And in fact, we have an extraordinary history, which is available. On every planet we have visited, there are ruins. And we're going to show you a new place tonight, courtesy of my colleague and friend Ruggiero, where he found, before we did, before anybody did, he found another island of amazing organized architecture on a world where you could not imagine such a complex existing. which only goes to show how little we know about the environment, the true environment of the solar system, and what has happened over preceding years and decades. So, with that as background, I want to introduce my guest tonight, because we've got some very special people. We've got Andrew Curry, who's with us. Andrew is a professional artist. He works on film, works on commercials, works on private commissions. That's a little in-joke between us. And he's done incredible service for the Enterprise mission on the other side of midnight in turning things that only certain eyes can see, because you can pick patterns out of the noise. And a lot of this, Daisy, because we're considering looking at ruins, it's very noisy. Ruins do not look like new things. Most people in our culture only look at new things. Therefore, they have this inbuilt inability to, without being kind of pointed out, to see ruins, because we're not familiar with ruin. Everything around us is pretty new and shiny with sharp edges. So without further ado, Andrew, welcome to the other side of midnight.
Hi, Richard. Thanks for having me on.
Okay. As my grandmother used to say, you're welcome. We've got Ron Gerbron with us. Excuse me. I think we have Ron with us. If not, he's on his way home and he will join us shortly. Ron is, of course, our resident generalist. Ron is really, really, really focused on Mars. So to get him to kind of look at the moon occasionally is not a trivial task, but I want his sagacity in terms of what he sees, because tonight we're going to do a little quiz. Toward the end of the show, we're going to do a little quiz, and you're going to respond by connecting either by email or in the comments section of Radio with Pictures, because I really want to know what a lot of people think, given the overwhelming amount of evidence we have tonight that we are literally not living in a desolate ruin. We're living in an ancient, formerly inhabited solar system where all kinds of astonishing things have gone on. And we're privy to none of it unless we open our eyes and we simply, really carefully begin looking. So before we bring on Andrew and Ron, and Ruggiero is going to join us from England probably in a couple of hours or so, let me go through four items at the top of the heap. Item number 2 in Radio with Pictures, item number 3, 4, and 5. Back in 2012, a poster on YouTube with the pseudonym Crow777 began posting a series of videos taken with a very high-resolution video system and a pretty decent large scale amateur telescope, like a Meade or a Celestron. I forget what he was using, but it was something on the order of, I think, 14 inches objective diameter, which by current standard is a big telescope, particularly when you marry it to state-of-the-art digital technology. And what Crow77 did was to take video of the moon. Now, the other three up there, his is number 2. Then there's number 3, which is an elaboration of his analysis taken many years later. Then we have 4 and 5, which are 2 separate videos by other videographers who have seen and recorded exactly the same thing. What Crow777 found in 2012 was in videoing the moon one night, he captured 2 extraordinary events which look like shock waves racing between the poles of the moon. First one, and then about 30 seconds later, then another. And they move. You can literally see in the video them moving from the South Pole to the North Pole and disappearing. And then the other one following on behind also disappearing as the first wave passes. Now, how do you see a shock wave on the moon? Well, you look for light changes. And what you can see when you look at some of the slow-mo close-ups, which are in number 3, you can see features on the surface of the moon apparently bend and warp and then come back into focus as the waves pass. If you look at the edges of the moon, what we call the limb, you can see literally changes of brightness and geometry at the limb, which precede exactly in accordance with the wave moving across the surface of the moon, except it's much more visible at the limb because there it's a change in brightness as well as a change in refractivity, meaning things under it are moved around because light is somehow being bent or refracted. I mean, this is, to say the least, incredibly controversial. And if I'd had more time, I probably could have dug up more examples of this phenomenon. But tonight, I really want to lay out in great detail the fact that this is something physically going on the moon, which should not be visible, but in fact, it is. And not just from one observer. There's now been, what, this is 2024, that's 12 years since this first example was posted on the web. There have been many other observers who have photographed, videoed through their telescopes the similar, if not identical, phenomenon. And it appears that it can start anywhere on the moon and then wrap itself completely around the moon in a few minutes. And I calculated the velocity of the wave that would create such an optical effect would have to be in order to move at the rate around the moon that we can measure. And it turns out to be slightly over 200 miles per second. Yeah, you heard me right. The wave is moving at 200 miles per second around the curvature of the moon. Not once, not twice, but countless times captured by random people who are happen to be videoing the moon when whatever's going on goes on. Now, that implies so many staggering potential limitations and reasons why it should not be that we're going to defer that to our conversation when I bring on the rest of my panelists. But I want to kind of set the stage because this is all occurring against a backdrop where we're literally finding out that there is something over the moon, which is not what anyone would expect as a physical object, basically somehow cloaking the moon to where it's basically physically impossible for some of these numbers that I just recited to be real, unless we're dealing at something which at some very basic level seems to be an optical illusion, except it's not, as we will see when we come back. We're now at the bottom of the hour, and what we're going to do is to take a small break here. My guests will come on when we come back. We're going to be talking tonight about an earth-shaking, politically earth-shaking development, because lo and behold, all of this is prelude to the imagery from the Intuitive Machines unmanned mission to the moon that gave us stunning new data on an ancient, ancient lunar glass dome. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return.
CyberMidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Support the broadcast to provide you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. The other side of midnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone, on this Saturday night, March 23rd, 2024. One third gone already. It's amazing. No, one quarter. Yeah, 3 months. It's amazing how time is flying. In fact, tomorrow night, I'm going to have Rick Levine and George Lambert on. We're going to be talking about this extraordinary visual extravaganza that's going to go from one coast to the other, the April 8th total eclipse of the sun. And we're going to be talking about time disjunctures, time out of time, why time is different than it used to be. We can actually measure it. Anyway, it's going to be a really interesting follow-on to tonight's show, because if we're literally dealing with an extraterrestrial technology involving something creating shockwaves, racing at 200 miles per second from pole to pole. That implies to me, as I said, you know, on the show several weeks ago, that somebody has been monkeying around with this ancient, super advanced Arthur C. Clarke third law level technology, and it may have side effects, in which case maybe they don't know totally what they are doing. So let me bring on my first guests. I believe Andrew is with us. You there, Andrew?
Yes.
Excellent. Where do we want to dive in tonight? Because I want to get to some of these images because they're so extraordinary. Like I want to look at number six, okay? Take a look at number six.
Actually, Richard.
Yeah?
Before you do that, can I relate to a very quick story about something you mentioned in your preamble?
Yeah, well, remember, it's all loosey-goosey here. We have no script. Ah. Or if we did, we would light it and burn it every night because we never follow it. So go ahead.
Well, you said something interesting. You're introducing me, but, you know, you mentioned Ron, you mentioned Keith Laney, Ruggiero, I mean, all of us, and just having sort of a keen eye for ruins. And it brought to mind two things. One, I remember years and years ago when I used to be a lifeguard and I used to walk to work. One of the pools I worked at, it was a bit of a walk, but I didn't have a car or whatever. Anyways, I walked by this neighborhood. Well, I was through neighborhoods, but there was this one house that had been standing and then it had been demolished. And I didn't see it actually happening. I just came one day, it was standing. The next day it was down. And, you know, even I remember looking at the sort of the destruction and the rubble and just thinking how there was a beauty in its destruction because there was still this sort of imploded geometry going on. I mean, I didn't think about it that way at the time. I'm saying that now to articulate the way we speak about ruins, but there was just order even in the disorder, you know, even in its collapse, you could see, you know, the artificial hand.
Yes,
was there.
The only way you can tell that it was built by somebody, because even as it's falling into ruin, the geometry, the archetypal geometry is preserved and preserved and preserved until it's the last thing to go.
Yeah. And then the other thing I thought about was, so, and this is another side light. So I've been a bachelor for about 10 days with my youngest son. He and I have been like bachelors because my wife is down in Arizona with my other two sons. My middle son plays baseball and he's down there for a training camp and playing American high school teams and all this. Anyways, that's interesting, being a single parent, Richard, and being alone. But I'm with my sons and with birds and – or not birds. I mean, I'm with a hamster and cats and fish, so it's a pretty full house. But anyways, that's a whole – I have a whole new respect for those who have to battle it on their own. But anyways, the point of it was there's a chat going on amongst the team because a lot of the parents of the kids – remember, these are teenagers, sort of grade 10 to grade 12, so generally 16 to 18 years old. And there was a chat going on, and it was a day off, and one of the parents had put in a picture of himself wearing this giant black helmet from, I don't know, it was a Costco somewhere in Arizona, and he was smiling into the camera, and people were laughing, and ha, 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 and somebody said, oh, you've put a whole new, Lee, you've put a whole new term to the idea of pinhead. And I lied to myself. Yeah, and Richard, this is the lawyer that I was telling you about that is involved in possibly space industries. So I knew right away what Lee was doing. So I went and quickly went to YouTube, grabbed a quick video clip from Spaceballs with, guess who, Dark Helmet, you know, the giant helmet on it. And I put it in, and Lee goes, bingo, Andrew, you're the only one that got it. That's what I was trying to get across. And I made a comment. I said, well, Lee, these days – lateral thinking is a rare commodity. And I said, and it was deathly silent. And then I think Lee felt bad and he reached out to the lawyer fellow and said, oh, I guess your intelligence was coming from a different place. Anyways, it's just to your concept is that people, like, unless you're told what it is, what you can't imagine, you can't see.
Exactly.
It's really simple. It's so elementary. And our educational system here in the States has gone to hell in a handbasket. Nobody is taught anything that would be useful except being programmed to have a job and pay taxes and support a government. That's all they want citizens for anymore, just be an endless source of the money supply. And teaching people how to think and how to start from first principles and figure things out is absolutely not as part of the educational landscape anymore.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, definitely here in Canada, well, here in British Columbia, same kind of thing. You know, there was a recent study done by a group called the Fraser Institute. It's sort of a kind of a conservative think tank here in the province that sort of measures out how, you know, industry is doing and how the schools are doing compared to how much money the government puts into it. Cause we're a public, you know, there's a huge public school system here, just like in the States. And, you know, BC falls, like, we do not rank very high, even within our country, like the education level of how much money, comparatively speaking, is put in to the results that they're from the students. So you're right. There's a real, it's almost as if people's brains have been concretized.
Well, it's almost as if it was deliberate.
Yeah.
How do you sabotage a democracy? You dumb people down to where they don't really realize why democracy is crucial to life. And anything else is not life, and they won't be making money, and they won't be secure, and they won't be happy. And just look around the world, and it seems that our people are so incredibly insulated. Oh, this can never happen here. And we're balanced on the knife edge because people cannot imagine what they cannot see.
Yeah, it's going to take quite a... like you say, quite a revelation.
It needs to be a big, bomb blast psychologically in the midst of our culture to get us to lift our eyes and realize whatever stupid things are going on here, they pale into insignificance compared to what's going on out there and what used to go on out there and why we are here not knowing that there is an out there. The evidence is overwhelming. And the fact that nobody but us chillins seem to realize it, and I'm being very dramatic here, of course, because there's a lot of people all over the world, but they're inchoate. They're not organized. They don't, have a political party. They don't run candidates. They don't do anything politically that would have the system reward them by acknowledging their concerns and their potential. And so tonight we have a major staggering political problem. How do we take this data now that we've worked so hard, so many decades to get the real goods, and how do we make it politically understandable to the rest of our culture, our civilization, so that people act on it? Because if we're going down the same trail we're going down tonight, I can see the end of that trail and nobody is going to be happy.
Yeah. Well, you wanted to get to number six.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Well, number six. Now, it turns out I haven't actually looked at this data for a long time. I gave my first public presentation at the National Press Club with a faculty of some pretty amazing people, geologists and technologists and, you know, space, you know, people that worked in the space program or tangentially. And we had like a 3-hour press conference at the National Press Club on March 21st, 1996 in the main ballroom. And then we got written up on the front page of the Washington Post. Now, you're probably wondering why I have not posted the link to the Washington Post piece. Well, I didn't, because when I read it, I realized it was awful. They literally attacked every person on the panel. They attacked me personally, all kinds of ad hominems. I was accused of being a pseudo-scientist. Of course, I was presenting NASA data. I was presenting what the U.S. government and the American taxpayer had paid billions for, but that didn't matter. I'd been a NASA consultant. I'd been Cronkite's science. It didn't matter. I was on the front page of the Washington Post. I was a pseudo-scientist. How the world has changed. Because now the Washington Post is doing serious UFO stories. The New York Times is doing serious UFO stories. The Pentagon is busily ignoring serious UFOs. In other words, we've changed, but we haven't changed because there still is not that capability going to verify what we've just said in the first half hour and not wait for a UFO to show up and land on the White House lawn. That appears to be what the UFO crowd is really waiting for, although our friend Steve Bassett wants, of course, hearings in the Senate, in the Intelligence Committee, and I'm wondering if he's ever going to get what he wishes, because as long as it's not dealt with at a political level, the culture can afford to ignore it based on the idea that, well, nothing's happened in the last 70 years, so probably nothing's going to happen on the next 70 years. That's a bad bet, by the way. So anyway, if you look at item number six, the technology has now evolved so incredibly dramatically that I can go on the internet, I can Google lunar imaging amateur astronomers, I can pull up absolutely random close-up color digital views taken through, again, commercial telescopes that are not very expensive anymore, of the moon. And with a little bit of playing with contrast and enhancement of detail, bingo. Amateur astronomers, as you can see in number six, two separate guys there, Corey Schmitz, and what's the other guy's name?
Brandy Astro.
Yeah.
Brandy.
Yeah, Brandy. Anyway, two separate guys. I don't think they even know each other. Take pictures of the moon with their own telescopes and cameras, and bingo, there's the damn dome, including the details, the fact that it's multiple layers, the fact that the first layer is much closer to the surface than the higher layer. Matching, independent confirmation. Now, you would think that if an amateur astronomer took this picture and posted on the web, there'd be all kinds of people that would go, holy cow, Corey, or holy criminy, Brandy, what did you photograph? Nobody is noticing. Because, of course, the thing you see in number six is impossible. There cannot be in our lexicon, in our heritage, in our, you know, perception, in our kind of scheme of how does reality work, there can be no allowance for something as staggering as a dome well, multi-layered glass that literally encompasses, or at one time did encompass, the entire spherical area of a planetary body 2,000 miles in diameter. There simply is not. There's nobody who can comprehend that reality because, of course, we can't do it. And, you know, there's that old, was it John Donne, man is the measure of all things, or was that Shakespeare? The point is that as long as you compare what we're finding out there with what we can do, we're always going to be behind the eight ball because we can do almost nothing compared to our ancestors or whoever was here before or whoever redesigned the system and whoever may have in fact left us here as part of some very complicated consciousness experimental project. Who knows? When we find the libraries, we may find out some of those answers. But here we have amateur astronomers, and they weren't even looking. They didn't even take the images to see the dome. All I did was take their published images and brighten them up, introduce a little contrast, a little saturation of the color, and bingo. So this is incredibly democratizable, and it's going to ultimately have to become generally known because people are spending money now to send private missions to the moon. And from the days of Apollo, where we were incredibly brave and resolute and geniuses at landing on a place where no one had ever landed before, in the modern era, of course, now about half of the current missions are failing and crashing. And those that are succeeding are doing it by the literal skin of their teeth. You know, we've got a Japanese mission which turned upside down and is sitting upside down on the lunar surface. We've got a U.S. mission, the Intuitive Machines private corporation mission of February 22nd, which landed barely, broke landing legs, tilted over, and is now kind of like the leaning tower of Luna. It's tilted over by about 30 degrees, but the cameras still work, and everything else is still working. And what's really bizarre is that the imagery that they have been sending to Earth and then making public, but without comment, show stunning observations and correlations and confirmation of an incredibly gauzy, translucent, almost not there because of immense periods of erosion, ancient lunar glass dome surrounding the entire moon. And all you have to do is look at number 7. The image on the left is a dewarped 180-degree wide-angle picture taken by Intuitive Machines, put through software that basically makes it presentable to what a human would see looking out the window if there was a window on the spacecraft. And the object on the right in the double composite I made is a close-up of the area of the sky just to the left of the word building. When you look at that, Andrew, what do you see?
Well, before I answer, Richard, I don't know if we went over how to get to these images, just for new people that listen, because we know that many listen from all over the world. Could you just quickly describe to everybody how to get there?
One more time with feeling. Okay, you go to theothersideofmidnight.com. Now, that's our homepage. You click on tonight's banner at the top, which says A Piece of the Action, Part 2, or March 23rd. Click on that banner. That will take you to the guest page. And when you're on the guest page, just right under it, you will see it says guest page, fast links to items. Click on my name or Andrew's when we talk about his images or Ruggiero's when we get to him. Click on my name. That will take you to the section of the page called Radio with Pictures down below, and you just scroll down to number 6 and number 7. We were talking about number 7, where I've got a wide-angle dewarp version of one of Intuitive Machines' 180-degree, wide-angle fisheye lens images. And then on the right, I've done a close-up of a section of that structure in the ceiling, in the sky, in the vault of heaven above the moon, where where you say buildings just looked about the 7 o'clock position. And that's where I grabbed that little inset and magnified it so you can see what's there. What do you see is there?
Well, I see organized structure. I don't see an open space at all.
And it's got tons of color.
Yeah.
Why would it have color?
Well, if it's glass, it's going to be refracting.
Well, exactly. Huh. And mixing the streams or mixing the frequencies. So you get not just primary colors, but you get things like deep violet or magenta or cyan or whatever. So you get a multitude of prismatic colors looking up into what should be absolutely dead black space.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we're not. And nobody except us around the entire planet is noticing. What
Richard,
is wrong? What is wrong with people? Do they think this is the way? Look, let me give you my prejudice.
Right.
I think people are so disenfranchised from their environment. They know nothing of how reality works outside of what they see on TV or from a politician. That until someone lays out exactly what they're looking at, all they do is say, oh, that's an alien picture of the moon. Boy, that's a weird place. Period. Period. They have no idea this is impossible. Impossible.
Or there's something wrong with the camera, or I don't know, I don't have time for this. It's going to be something along those lines. Richard, do you think that the camera, this sort of fisheye lens was used to, I mean, this really, you know, grabs, it's wide angle, so it really grabs.
Yeah, 180 degrees. Actually, it's 186.
Yeah.
So it's looking slightly around the corner behind you if you're thinking of yourself behind that lens. Absolutely.
Yeah.
For two different reasons, if I can interrupt. One is they wanted a wide-angle shot, so they got the entire environment on the way down. These are pictures taken not on the surface, but in orbit descending to the surface. Because remember, the previous missions, half of them have failed. Obviously, somebody said, wait a minute, maybe we're going to crash. So they decided to take wide-angle 180-plus degree circular images on the way down. So even if they did crash, this was broadcast in real time. So they could get data back on Earth that would survive the crash, if only one or two images. And obviously what you're seeing is this image was taken about 6 miles above the lunar surface. So you're above the surface, but you're below the upside-down geometric carpet of a lunar glass dome, which looks incredibly solid, right?
Yeah.
The only reason it looks solid is because you're looking through so many damn miles of it.
Right.
You know, if you have a pair of gauze curtains, like I said to George the other night, and you stand back from the window, they look solid, right? But things seen through them are dimmer. And then when you get really close, you see that the lace curtains are filled with holes. That really most of the surface is not a surface at all. It's just a hole so you can look through the curtain. That's the density of this, except it's so much less dense than a pair of lace curtains. It's probably of the consistency, as I've said now for several years based on some measurements, it's probably consistency of cigarette smoke, which means you can fly through it, and unless you have sensors on the hull of your spaceship, you won't even know it. And you know why there's so much blue?
Why?
Particle scattering. This goes back to the first question every kid asks his mommy. Why is the sky blue? You know the answer, right?
I know we've gone over this, and you're going to get mad at me, but
It's all right. Because the size of molecules are all just about the same, regardless of what they're made of. Molecules are about the same size as a wavelength of blue light. So if you have physical structure, like little tiny glass shards that are attached to a matrix, like a huge netting or scaffolding. We'll get into that shortly. Whatever little specks are left, they're small enough that they interact most fiercely with blue light. So in the first images I looked at from Ken Johnson, where he'd spirited original film away from NASA and at the Johnson Space Center, when he was told as curator of the film to destroy it, instead he took it home and took it to his university. Days later, he gave it to me to scan, and I found all kinds of blue structures in the sky of the moon that shouldn't be there, but the blue part was very fitting because it meant that whatever particles were in the sky were the same size as molecules that scatter blue light in the Earth's atmosphere. Now, the Earth, of course, is nitrogen and oxygen, right?
Yeah.
Jupiter's atmosphere above the clouds is primarily hydrogen and helium, right?
Yeah.
But above the clouds on Jupiter, you have blue skies because the size of the hydrogen molecule is the same size as the nitrogen molecule or the oxygen molecule, bounces blue light preferentially. So that's how we know that atmosphere colors are kind of irrespective of the composition, but are determined primarily by the size of the particles scattering sunlight. And on the moon, around the moon, there is this multi-layered, incredibly complicated glass set of shells that have been reduced now through erosion. God knows how many millions of years of erosion, to where the particles surviving are of the order of wavelengths of blue light. So that's why you see all the blue. It's scattering from something so tiny that you could literally send a spaceship through it and not even notice unless you looked out the window.
I'm listening to you, as everybody else is and should be, and I'm having a little back and forth with one of your listeners. He's great. I think it's Michael, and I won't share his last name just because I don't know if he'd want me to. And he's popping back at me with images that he's plucked off, you know, Google, whatever, of photos of the moon. And he claims he's sort of tried to boost the, you know, like the contrast, Earth, you know, like try to get the same effect. And he's saying, hey, it's the dome is not showing up in these images. How do we, like, I mean, it's a valid question, right? Like, how do we explain to him what's going on? Is it matter of the pictures that he's using, or what do you say?
Well, yeah, it's all dependent on whoever took the pictures, and if they expose it long enough that you'd be able to see the dome down in the noise. Because remember, the dome is incredibly thin compared to the lunar surface, which of course
right.
is reflecting sunlight. So if you have something that is, let's say, three orders of magnitude dimmer than the surface lit by sunlight, three orders of magnitude would be 1,000 times dimmer, then you're not going to see with an average photograph what's on the moon. But if you, in fact, get the right images from the right people who either inadvertently took a long exposure or they, you know, simply did something that was, you know, not as part of their observation program, then, I mean, you have to look through a few images by a few, probably several dozen amateur astronomers, because what a number of astronomers do when they see this weirdness at the edge of the moon, they
right.
get rid of it.
Right.
They clip it out with a clip tool because their moon that they know does not have anything around it. Therefore, it's got to be light leaks. Therefore, it mars the dramatic image. And so they get rid of the data. Till you find, I mean, the first thing you can do is look up the amateurs that I've got listed, go to their websites, look at those same images, do the same thing to them, and you'll get the same result I got. And I didn't pick them by, you know, careful analysis. They were picked totally at random. Hey, we're at the top of the hour. We've talked through our break. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. You're on the other side of midnight. We shall return.
TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Support the broadcast and don't miss another groundbreaking conversation. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone, on this Saturday night, the 23rd, we turn that up a bit, of March 2024. My guests tonight are Andrew Curry. Ranjur Braun will be joining us shortly, as well as Ruggiero Kahlo, who is joining us from England with something pretty amazing. I mean, Ruggiero really did something pretty amazing. Can't wait to get him on. So, Andrew, where were we?
Just discussing Michael's question about, you know, you can't, like, not every moonshot that you get.
Exactly. It's like anything else, anything of value. You got to look and look and look until you find it. And I would start with the website of the two gentlemen. That's why I put their copyrights on the picture. So you can go to their website, download their images, because we know the dome is visible on their data, and just duplicate what I did. Increase the brightness, increase the contrast, you know, a little saturation, play around, look at the edge, look all around the moon, because the dome is not evenly distributed all around the moon. Parts of it are really, really eroded. So it's denser at the poles, and it's really dense on the far side, and it's almost non-existent on the near side, which is why Surveyor and the Apollo missions could land safely, because it's almost not there compared to other places around the moon. And of course, when you take a photo of the moon from the Earth, you're looking basically at the near side, but the limb, the edges are peeking around to the far side, where it's much, much, much denser. And there's an astronomical reason for that weird distribution, which I don't know if we have time to get into. It's not really important in finding how to verify this stuff, and then you can have fun with why, you know, why is it not the same density all over the moon? And I'll give you a big hint. It has to do with erosion. Micrometeorite erosion is not the same all over the moon. And we can leave that to the student to figure out why. Anyway, does that answer Michael's question?
Yeah, two more, Richard. Actually, one of them is mine and one of them is Michael. He asks, does Richard himself have a telescope capable of capturing the dome?
No.
You don't? Okay.
No.
Now the
But I have borrowed telescopes. You could actually go and borrow one on Mount Wilson. You have to pay for it. But you could use the 60-inch to do this if you're an amateur astronomer, and you basically just call them up and say, I want to reserve such and such a night. I'm going to bring my cameras. They will provide the technicians. They'll provide this incredibly large professional telescope on Mount Wilson above Los Angeles, 60-inch diameter mirror, which basically, you know, ushered in the era of astrophysics at the turn of the last century. It's an incredibly historic telescope. I had planned to go and use it sometime. And when they found out who I was, they will not rent the telescope to me. I wonder why. Gosh. Of course there's no censorship in the United States of America. Are you kidding? Of course there's no. Well, there is. And there's a huge story that goes with it, which I probably will put in one of the books I'm going to do on this someday. Because literally, well, that's a very long story. But yeah, anybody but me can go and rent that telescope and take pictures of the moon and verify everything we're saying. You just can't have the last name Hoagland. Andrew?
Yeah. So the other question, Richard, is I just got distracted. Sorry, my youngest just came in to say goodnight. And you guys,
good night, Stellan.
Everybody's saying goodnight, but you stay quiet for now. Could I? Can you see, like, what I'm noticing, and it's a conversation I've had with Ron as well, and I know Ron is sitting there, is sometimes on those really big full moon nights, with the naked eye, to me, I can see a glow around the moon. Now, is that just something in, you know, through an atmospheric effect, like just because?
It could be your atmosphere. It could be in your eyeballs. I mean, scattered light is a problem. That's why, to me, it's so interesting that these two independent amateurs had the telescope and the local conditions to see through a very clear atmosphere. And what's so cool is that both of them are seeing the same thing and photographing it thousands of miles apart, and they don't know each other. But you got to have the right atmosphere, the right optics, the right, we call seeing, you know. So, you know, if you're an amateur astronomer and you got the gear, yeah, this would be one incredible science project to do, because now the technology is such that you don't even have to go to the moon. You just sit on the Earth and take enough pictures with the right lighting and bingo, there it is.
Well, and the last comment I want to make, and I think I've made this before, is what I'm noticing is the moon seems to me to be getting brighter.
Yeah, you've talked about that for years, how it has this luminous quality that you didn't used to notice. I'm just wondering if it's just you're noticing more, you know, because the physics is changing and your awareness is changing, or maybe there is, because I don't see any different than I've always, but then I looked at the moon a lot. In fact, one night I drove from Miami to Cape Canaveral on I-95, the cops in Florida are going to love to hear this, as a test with my headlights turned out, driving by the light of a full moon reflecting off the seashells of the concrete of I-95, which are really reflective under a dark sky with a high moon. And I was able to drive hundreds of miles, A, without getting caught by the cops, and B, to test the idea that when your eyesight is dark adapted, moonlight is sufficient for driving on Earth, even at 70, 80 miles an hour. Do not repeat this. Please do not do this. I do not want to be responsible for, you know, pileups and wrecks and all that. It was an experiment. Okay? I've proven the experiment. Nobody else has to do it.
Well, anyways, yeah, no, that's something that I, like I said, Richard, I don't know if I've related this on the air, but, you know, and this is something I thought I only saw in the summer, but I even saw it recently in the dead cold of winter when we've had, you know, full moon. And is the light cast now on the Earth, well, in my area, is so, and this is another reason why I feel like it's brighter, is because it's so much more intense, and I'm seeing shadows and, like, delineations of shadows, like through trees from the moonlight that I've never seen
before. Well, have you gone to Google and asked the dumb question, is the moon brighter now than it used to be?
No.
You should do that.
Yeah.
Because maybe all it had to do would be some observatory that basically registered moonlight, because moonlight is the death knell for deep space astronomy. When the moon is up, you can't do all kinds of astronomical things at professional observatories that you normally would do when the moon is not in the sky, because it really blanks out, you know, the atmosphere. It scatters light. It makes the background much too bright to do galactic studies or whatever. I mean, there are lots of things you can do during full moon, but you can't do the deep, deep, deep space stuff, which, of course, is why we've got space telescopes now. So if there is some observatory that was concerned that their night seemed to be getting brighter, maybe somebody did an actual measurement. I mean, if I thought my way through it, I could probably do it myself in my copious spare time. Yeah, right. So we have a big audience. Somebody out there, either find it or do it yourself and let us know, because, you know, Andrew, for you that I've known, how long have I known you? It's been almost a decade. You've been saying for all that time, the moon is brighter, the moon is different, the moon, you know. Well,
it's starting to sound like Chicken Little.
Well, there's another possibility. Because if the dome, which I really now totally believe, is not a passive upside-down salad bowl, but was an active, smart grid architecture, glass, you know, electrically interactive, powered by something, interactive with something. In other words, if it was a smart architecture, I can see where it might be on a clock, if some of it's still working, to where it would increase the apparent reflectivity, even by a few percent, your eye being that sensitive would pick up. But without numbers, without real measurement, it's just, you know, it's just subjective.
Well, one thing okay, if this is just me being more aware or maybe something about the area that I live in, or maybe there's just a little less pollution to the sky on those nights or something, I don't know. But I'll tell you, Richard, the one thing that strikes me is when I've seen this sort of silvery white glow now that bathes the landscape, like the backyard. Like our backyard gets really black at night. I mean, it's like, unless our I have some, what do you call those little sidewalk glowing sticks that are, you know, solar powered, so they stay on when the light. But anyways, if those aren't on, it's like pitch black, and especially in the winter. Well, if this is indeed an ancient dome, and I think there's enough evidence to show us that, and I too have seen things now that are like, okay, for me.
Well, you haven't seen the new pictures at the end of our screen.
Yeah, we'll get there. And then, of course, from an artistic point of view, I mean, like, I'm hoping to do a little bit on Alan Bean tonight, because he was planting Easter eggs like you wouldn't believe.
Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up, because if you go and find the hit piece in the Washington Post, Google Washington Post Lunar Press Conference, March 21st, or actually 22nd, because that's when they posted the article, 1996. One of the weird ways that they, you know, dissed me, basically tried to undercut my credibility, they turned to Alan Bean in the article. And he's quoted in like a couple of paragraphs, oh, no, there's nothing like that, nothing like that there at all. But if we go back and look, and I don't have time, you can do it. I'm trying to remember, I think, Alan Bean's dramatic change paintings of the moon occurred after our 1996 March 21st press conference. And you can tell by the dates on the paintings.
Yeah, there's definitely an evolution in how he was, I'll put it this way.
Well, I'm wondering, again, it goes back to if you can't imagine it, you can't see it.
Yeah.
What if our press conference triggered one person to reach back into his memory and remember finally what he really saw? Because when you look at the dates, I mean, they really quote him extensively in this hit piece. And I'm beginning to think that our press conference and the Post bringing it to his attention, as a good scientist, it must have clicked that he had all kinds of private reservations or maybe memories or dreams or whatever, and then it came to a gestalt and he started doing paintings of the moon that are so wildly colorful, so blatantly non-lunar, as NASA has given us the moon, that I've got to wonder if maybe the inquiry from the Post didn't trigger him taking more seriously his own fragmentary memories.
I think there's something to that, Richard. And I think
all we have to do is look at the dates. Let's look at the dates.
Yeah.
And when I had this idea, I didn't have time to go look at the dates, so someone can do that. But I really think that we may have played a role in getting Alan Bean in touch with his higher self, to where he remembered what it really looked like. Because, I mean, look at image number 8 or number 9. If you're standing on the moon as an artist and looking up with your faceplate up, so you're not looking through the gold visor, but you're looking through the clear visor, it must have been breathtaking.
Yeah.
And that would have connected with his right brain as opposed to his left brain, which basically was told by NASA, there's nothing there, move along, move along.
Oh, yeah, and definitely as when we first, quote-unquote, met on air and talking about Alan Bean, he's relating that structured look that he would have seen looking up through a very carefully designed ground, meaning he would prepare he usually used mostly like a hardboard, and then he would put, I call it gesso, but other people say gesso, but it's like a like a mud, right? Like you just get more texture.
Well, I know at least one professional artist, and I think she says gesso.
I say gesso. Some people say gesso, but anyways. But Richard,
Andrew, I've never heard anybody call it anything but gesso.
Well, I call it gesso, but I've been corrected for many things, including from you, Ron. But I wanted to add one more thing.
Not about that, yeah, but not about that, sir.
Okay. Well, no. Ron and Ruggiero are here, but I wanted to add one more thing, Richard. The thing that strikes me, and I think I've related the story, is the look of the full moon. When we get full moons here in the Pacific Northwest, it's so magical. I can't explain it. It's no longer this sort of soft moonlight. It's this, well, it's still soft, but it's this silvery white bathed landscape that has such depth. And I remember I think I told you this, at the time he was 15, my son was going to bed and I said, Hey, Alaric, pop up and look out the window. Cause he has a window in his bedroom that looks out onto the back lawn. And he popped his head up and he went, and this is from, one of the, a droll teenager, like everything's out, whatever. And he looked out the window and he went, whoa. And I'm telling you, Richard, and this was the light just shining down. If the moon, and I believe there is a dome there, or was a dome and there's still remnants, that not only was, I believe, and this is total speculation, of course, all of it is, but that not only was it holding an environment, but it may have been playing a part at night on an effect here on Earth. Now, this is just I thought of and statues and colonnades when I looked at this light. It reminded me of that movie. Oh, do you remember? It's the book Martian Chronicles. They made a movie of it.
Yeah, Ray Bradbury with Rock Hudson.
Yeah. Right, and there was
in several installments, and they I forget where they shot. It was somewhere in South America, I think. But they had these weird plazas that looked very alien.
Yes, and the way they lit it, that film, it even though it was, I think, more of a different light than a moonlight, of course, but it harkened back in my brain that moment of watching that film, and there was just this stillness and this beautiful, it's almost like this ethereal effect, like just the entire landscape was unified in this light, and I believe there's a healing effect to it or something. Maybe it's a consciousness thing. Again, these are total speculations, but what I'm saying is that dome may have had many functions, not just to cover the moon, but to have an effect here on Earth.
Well, yeah, no, you keep talking about the Earth-Moon system, and I was asked the other day, well, why would you have a dome? Remember Nova asked
yes,
that several weeks ago on the show?
Yes.
Basically, a dome is to shield you from something outside.
Right.
Either from radiation or electromagnetic radiation like ultraviolet. You can get a very bad sunburn. That's why they had the gold helmets on the astronauts. Or it could be hard radiation, particle radiation. In other words, this dome probably served many, many, many different functions, up to and including maybe it was some kind of defensive shield against whatever was happening millions of years ago in the solar system. We won't know until we find the libraries.
And Richard, I know Ruggiero and obviously Ron are here on the line.
Well, let me go back to number 8 because I want to get a few of these under our belt so we have something to talk about. Number 8 is a composite pewter model that an architecture student named Bob Piertek and I put together back for the 1996 National Press Club extravaganza, basically created from the ray tracing of the Apollo imagery that I had been analyzing for like a couple of years before. And on the right-hand side, there is a close-up of the lunar surface and the arc of the 180-degree lens that has been rectified now. This has been put through software to turn it into a kind of a panoramic landscape. And you can see the same kind of crystalline, box-like, cubical glass structures there to the left of the overexposed image of the sun shining through the dome that we see in the model on the left-hand frame of the same photo. In other words, we successfully predicted 28 years ago the geometry of this incredible superstructure around the moon that the Intuitive Machines spacecraft, Odysseus, has now confirmed.
And Richard, if people like double click on their mouse or whatever their system is and have a look at this image on the right.
Yeah, they get much bigger. The images get much bigger.
Yeah.
All right.
And there are some iconography or designs or something in this stuff it's absolutely extraordinary. It's something that I'm gonna work on. I hope Ruggiero thinks about this too, because it's not just geometry. There is design in there, in my opinion, or what I'm seeing, and I'm gonna go and tackle it at some point.
Let's go to number nine. Number nine is two photos, and the reason I put these together is because this mission, this Odysseus mission, had two separate sets of cameras. One from Intuitive Machines, which built the spacecraft, and the other from a group called the International Lunar Observatory Association, based in Hawaii, which was able to pay Intuitive Machines to take two paying payloads, two cameras on the same spacecraft, one of which was a wide angle, the other which was a framing camera that would see narrow angle. We've seen no images from the narrow angle camera, but we've seen a number of images from the wide angle camera from the International Lunar Observatory. What you see in number nine is both of those cameras with the same field of view taken at different altitudes above the moon. The International Lunar Observatory camera took that photo on the left, probably several miles up. The image on the right was taken about 100 feet up by the Intuitive Machines cameras just before landing. If you look at the sky, there is incredible identical geometry in both. The crescent to the left of the sun is the Earth. That's the crescent Earth, 2 degrees across, to give you a sense of scale. But what's really weird, Andrew, is do you notice the color of the moon in the two separate shots?
The one on the left is pink, obviously.
And the one on the right is not.
Yeah.
It's bluish.
Yeah.
With other, why is the color so different? Obviously, it didn't change composition in the few seconds it took to go from image on the left to image on the right. Remember, they're landing, they're descending on the rocket thrust, so they're coming down at several hundred feet per second at this altitude.
Right.
So why is the color different?
Okay, how high up?
Mr. Artist, how high up is
the left again? The left-hand side?
A few miles.
And then the right is just 100?
About 100 feet, yeah. I'm remembering the numbers.
Well, maybe it's coming through at a different part of the glass.
Yes, of course. Of course.
So Richard, this would also explain why Alan Bean painted the landscape of the moon in different colors as well, because, mind you, he wasn't up there for days. It was only a few hours, right? And then they were gone. But,
They had three EVAs, three separate days. So they would come out in their morning, and they spend 6 to 8 hours doing their stuff. Apollo 12 was two EVAs. I'm sorry.
Two.
Yeah. So they had a total of maybe, 10 hours, 12 hours, something like that, outside.
So he could have been seeing the sun at different angles too, which may have affected how the colors were being.
Exactly, because the moon rotates 13 degrees per day. So when they came out the second morning, the sun would have been 13 degrees higher in the east than it was. So the angle between the sun and the surface and the glass was all different. And it depends on which part of the glass, because remember, in our model, a lot of it's not there. So you have things that are denser and sticking up, and then you have empty space where there's nothing. So you're going to get this patchwork of stained glass projection from the dome on the moon and the mixing of colors,
right,
which takes us to number 10. Because number 10 is simply the left-hand image of number 9 put through this software by ILO that makes basically a panorama out of a circular 180-degree image.
Right.
And you can see, look where the shadows are. Follow the shadows and the craters on the surface. You can see where the sun is coming from the shadows.
Right.
And it's about 180-degree field of view. Right?
Yeah.
Well, look at the right-hand edge of the moon. Look at how bright that surface is. It's back scattering the sunlight.
Yeah.
And then you look at the sun itself, and we'll do that closer in a couple of minutes. But in between the left edge of the picture where the logo for ILO is and the sun on the left side and the logo on the right side, look at all the stuff in the sky.
Yeah.
That shouldn't be there.
Yeah.
Come on. And you're apparently taking video. So we have frames. I'm not sure it was 60 frames per second. But we have very high-speed video. Well, we don't. They do. And if I'm right, the colors should change dramatically as the spacecraft changes angle with the sun, with the dome, with the larger chunks that are still glass, so they really, you know, refract light and refract it prismatically. So now you look at number 11. This is now a close-up of that bizarre sun. Have you ever seen the sun look like this? Should the sun look like this from the surface of an airless world? Those are not, you know, lens flares. That is not in the lens. Because if you look at number 12, and if you click on it, it gets really big. Look at all the geometry around the edges of the overexposed sun in number 12. Oh, it's stunning.
It's back to the
gauze, that sort of.
Yes, exactly, because it's shattered glass. It's incredibly, you know, non-dense. Well, what's the right word? Thin, low density. It's like lace curtains, except a million times less dense.
Right.
And the only reason say again?
Diaphanous.
That's a good word. I love that. Yes.
Okay.
That was Ron. Ron, who's our generalist who knows the word diaphanous applied to lace curtains. But yeah, it's very diaphanous because if you look through miles of something that almost doesn't exist, with enough miles it will exist, what's called the optical depth. The reason that we're able to land at all is because most of it is as ghostly as a specter, as Casper. Only some chunks are remaining, and you want to avoid those because they will kill you. They will kill your spacecraft. They will kill you if you're in the spacecraft. And over the poles, it's much, much denser than it is on the near side where Apollo landed. That's why we got them down safely, because there's almost no glass over the side of the moon that faces the Earth. Now, let's go back to image number 7, okay? What do you see about the left-hand underside of the dome, again, taking about 6 miles up, in the left side of number 7? Besides the presence of structures which should not be there, what's the other thing that kind of strikes you?
Well, it's big bands.
Bands are doing what?
Well, they're going away from us.
They're swooping. They're not straight lines. They're curved.
Yeah,
why are they curved? Because the architecture is curved. Now we go down to number 13. This is now, on the left is another close-up taken by, I think it was the Intuitive Machines camera. Notice the racked, curved tiers of structure above the horizon. It's gorgeous! And it's a pale vestige of what it used to be. Okay? And I think I'd blown through the break at the bottom of the hour. That's fine.
Oh.
On the right-hand side, these are black and white close-ups of the thing we call the castle, which I found on an Apollo 10 image taken from the lunar module as the lunar module was streaking down across Tranquility in a kind of a test scenario for Apollo 11. And this object is sitting about 9 miles above the surface, as you can tell from the larger context images. But the reason I have a moderately close view, and then in the right I have a very close view, you see that little white line connecting this object to the edges of the frame?
Yeah.
You see what it's doing?
Well, it's following a curve.
It's sagging. It's following a curve. The curve is called a catenary curve, and it's the same curve that would be formed if you give Anna a brooch on a neck chain and you hold it between your two hands waiting to put it around her throat, and the middle of it will sag. Why does it sag? Because of gravity. A catenary curve is a very precise mathematical definition of weighted objects on chains or ropes or strings or cables that are suspended in a gravity field above a surface. You're seeing catenary curves in the dome. How does a light effect, how does a trick of light and shadow, how does a lens flare even know how to spell catenary, let alone what it means? It doesn't.
And repeat it.
It doesn't.
And repeating it.
Well, yeah, like ranks of tiered balconies.
Yeah.
You know, and now what we'll do is we'll go in and we'll figure out all the numbers and how much of the surface you're seeing there and how high it is and all that. But I'm sure we're looking at, you know, several tens of miles vertical. And they're all following the same curve, right? Astonishing.
It's, well, the thing that strikes me, Richard, and I realize you've brought up the you know, you intensified the colors, but if it wasn't there, it wouldn't come out.
Exactly.
And it's extraordinarily sensitive.
Remember the dome itself is so dim compared to the surface because it's not even there. Density-wise, it's almost not there. So you have to crank up some things to see it. What I'm amazed about is I was able to get the balance so you can actually see details on the surface as well as the dome, and the dome would be barely visible with your naked eye if you were standing there in a spacesuit looking through a helmet.
But it's hauntingly artistic and beautiful.
Of
That's
course.
The thing.
It makes the Sistine Chapel look like a mud flat. It's going to be absolutely fantastic for live video from the moon when, you know, Elon Musk gets his tourists to go into orbit and someday land. So let's look at number 14 because we're coming to something really exciting here, and then I want Ron to join the conversation. This is now a close-up of what you see in image number 9. Okay, number 9, close-up. Look at the on the left, the ILO telescopic camera. Look at the crescent Earth on the left, then look at that matrix, and then the sun. Is that real, or is that just in the lens?
again, Richard, the design here is, it's Kirby-esque. to go back to Jack Kirby, and it's, I mean, call it alien, whatever you want to call it. It's, you know what it reminds me of? A lot of this stuff we're looking at, and this is unbelievably beautiful again. It's Spirograph. Remember that stuff from the 70s the kids used to play with? I think
didn't they call it an Etch-a-Sketch or something?
Well, Spirograph was where you put your pencil in. I think I had one. And you'd make like circles and circles and circles and the circles within circles and all these really cool.
I remember that.
Well, this is like it has an order and a design. Again, I've seen this on surfaces what we're seeing, or you know, whether it be spaceships or you know, within our solar system. Like what I'm saying is that we're seeing a design that's being repeated throughout our solar system, in my opinion, and this is just another example of it. It's beautiful. It's wow. Curlicues and everything. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I'm just staring into it.
Well, if people like Mike, who, you know, are obviously very skeptical, if he's saying that this is simply lens flare, then I have an absolute 100% test to prove it is or it isn't. Okay, which brings us to 15. Number 15 is my wide angle of the ILO, the International Lunar Observatory camera, wide angle image of the moon and the Earth and the distorted sun, can, you know, a few miles up as they were descending. If you look closely, you'll see all kinds of incredible geometry just above the moon. On the right of the same image is an enlargement, like I have number 14. And then below that, in the bottom right, is a close-up of the Earth. What is wrong, Andrew, with that Earth?
Well, it's got structure. I think it should be smooth.
Of course.
And it's bent. Like
it's incredibly distorted, like it was being viewed through miles upon miles upon miles of layered glass.
Yeah.
Now look at number 16. I actually found an Earth image shot through a window of 100-year-old glass, because where they used to make glass, it wasn't flat like it is now. It had waves in it. This is the absolute test of why this is all real, because a light reflection, a scattering of light in a lens, cannot create the physical distortion of the Earth we're seeing through the glass.
Right.
It can only be glass that can do that. A physical refractive medium is between you and the Earth 239,000 miles away. Which, by the way, is the reason why all the ideas for using the moon as a observatory, the International Lunar Observatory, but their grand plans are going to come to nothing. You can do no real astronomy from the moon because of the dome.
Well, they could do art.
they can do art, but they can't do astronomy. Can you imagine stars from the moon in a vacuum would be a diffraction-limited point, right? So let's say you set up your telescope and you're doing a spectra of a particular star in some particular constellation, right? And you're on the moon and the moon rotates very slowly, like takes 2 weeks to go around, you know, half, a month to go 360. So things in the sky barely move, right? But the problem is that if you're trying to photograph a star or take a spectra of a star, it's going to intercept one of those little tiny flecks of glass in the dome, and it will disappear. And then maybe 20 minutes later, it will come out from behind that little speck of glass, and you'll see it for maybe 3 or 4 seconds, and then it will go away again. There's no way that anybody with what's now around the moon can ever do professional-level astronomy from the moon, period. Let me take you to number 17, which is right below 16. On the left is an uncompressed image of a crescent Earth taken by the Voyager 1 spacecraft back in 1977 when it was departing the Earth-Moon system for Jupiter, the Jupiter flyby. When I saw this, I said, oh, the critics come in to say, oh, it's just JPEGing. So I then took that image and I cranked up the JPEG to the maximum compression, which you can see as the middle image. Then you want to look at the right-hand image, which is an enlargement to scale of the image you see up in number 16, the Earth's two-degree crescent as seen just away from the sun as it moves around the moon, apparently, once every month. So look at the distortion of the JPEG image, and now look at the distortion of the image that we are proposing is seen through miles of compartmented geometric glass. Do you see why one cannot be confused with the other?
Oh, yeah. No. The JPEGs, they're very specific. They're very, calculated.
Exactly. Yes, they're part of an algorithm.
Yeah, whereas this Odysseus Earth through the dome, well, first of all,
that's the test. That's how you know everything I've been saying for the last 2 hours is real, because you do not have a physical effect if you're just painting with light beams. Okay. As for number 18 is my, throw an example of why you can't shoot through the dome, because as Apollo 16 showed us with their lunar photography of the sky, their primitive electron telescope that was designed by the Naval Research Laboratory, a Dr. Carruthers, to photograph the ultraviolet universe from the surface of the moon, you can see when they took a picture of overhead, there's all kinds of crud in the sky that should not be there. Can you imagine doing a long exposure of Andromeda and that thing in the center of the right-hand image goes in front of your galaxy? Okay, I have reached the end of my, lexicon here. At this point, I can't wait for Ron's reaction. Ron, floor is yours.
Oh, hello.
Hi there.
I had an equipment problem in the interim, but that's okay. All right. Now, everybody should understand that my position is somewhat less rabid than Richard about the dome.
Okay, let me stop you there.
Why?
How do you refute what I've just shown you? How is it not a dome? Give me a model that says it's due to this as opposed to a dome.
There's a bunch of stuff overhead, but if you let me finish, okay. I'm looking at it from a more hypothetical standpoint. Okay.
I don't know what that means.
Everything you have presented so far has been presented as stamp my feet, this is absolutely it.
And I asked you to come up with another model.
Yeah, well, that doesn't mean that I have to produce a whole entire model, confront yours point to point. That's letting the other guy make the rules. I'm telling you my rules are, I have a hypothetical situation that covers much of it. This is not the same thing as debunking everything. So, hear me out. I'm willing to go with the idea that there's a dome there. I have a real problem with the idea that anyone down here, who presumably back in ancient times when it mattered, had some sort of say in the matter, wanted to look up at a snow globe. That's the simplest way to put it. And so, therefore, I'm thinking the dome was there, were it there, and we're just saying that it is, for some other reason. Now,
so far we're in total agreement.
Okay, see. So, now, let's just say that one of the things we can probably generally agree on is that the moon was towed into position because I have looked at, I think, every official presentation as to how the moon ended up where it is. And even though they can make some pretty good cases, the minor points of their cases about, well, this big chunk of the Pacific got ripped out by an impact of this, that, and the other thing. That still never explains how the moon ended up where it is, nor does it, thanks to the scarce information that NASA has provided us back from their missions, the evidence that correlates properly with, you know, what's really up there. So, okay, we have the moon overhead. Nobody argues about that. It has the remnants of some sort of structure over the top of it. Now you've pointed out several times that everything on this side relative to your dome is much sketchier than elsewhere because it's all been battered to pieces,
mm-hmm.
right? The funny thing is the moon acts as a sweeper, and traditionally a lot of meteors that would have hit the Earth hit the moon. And guess which side of the moon they hit? The side that isn't facing us. So that should have...
No, wrong.
Okay, why?
Because of celestial mechanics. The reason the moon on the side we look at, the glass is almost gone, that's the side that used to be facing front as the moon went around the Earth. You rotate the side we see 90 degrees to the left.
Mm-hmm.
And then the in-plane ecliptic micrometeorite abrasion, drastic abrasion from the explosion of Tom Van Flandern's planet, the one Mars used mm-hmm. to orbit, that filled the solar system with dust in-plane. If you encounter the same debris in-plane over and over and over and over again for a few million years, it's going to abrade everything on the front. Think of it as you're driving across the Sahara Desert in a Mercedes with a bowling ball on your hood as your hood ornament. And you drive clear, and you're driving into a sandstorm. So the front of the bowling ball will get all the brunt of the erosion. The part of the bowling ball facing you and the windscreen, the windshield, that almost doesn't get any erosion at all. So we have here a case of selective erosion of the front. Now, how did the moon wind up where that side, that used to be the front, rotated 90 degrees, so it's now facing the Earth? That's because the event that I'm picking out 66 million years ago that did all this celestial mechanics changing literally changed the internal gravity balance of the moon, a major impact, and the stop position left the moon in the orientation it's facing now, where the side that used to be on the front is now facing the Earth.
Does or does not the moon have a tidal bulge?
Yeah. Now.
Okay, which side, if now, today, of the moon is the tidal bulge on?
It's on the far side. It's on the far
side.
On the
far side relative to
the Earth. Yeah, okay.
Where is it in relationship to the thin part of the dome?
180 degrees away, like right through the moon. The higher part is facing away from the Earth on the far side of the moon. And it's only 2 or 3 miles. It isn't a huge tidal bulge. It's much less than the Earth's, you know, equatorial bulge. But it's a remnant, a fossil of an ancient time when the moon, you know, relaxed into that new position, which was a long time ago. And we know the moon can relax because we've measured now the moon has a molten core. The moon has a plastic mantle. So if you change its orientation in the gravity field, the egg shape will move slowly over millions of years to reconform to where the orientation is now.
Okay, fair answers. Point that I'm trying to make is that part of what's missing from the side that's facing us could have been due to the fact that there it was sitting there, and people on the ground had something they could easily take pot shots at
if they wanted to
get in the way of anything.
Come on. That's nuts. It's nuts,
what?
Ron. Would you calculate the number of square miles in the moon, please? You don't have to do it. It's 15 million square miles. What kind of weapon, and why would someone do something like try to destroy all the glass on the Earth-facing side. That's nuts.
I didn't say who tried to do it. I didn't say that anyone tried to destroy all of it, although that might have happened.
You're introducing factors we have no idea. I can explain what we see.
Tom Vanderlander's model is a factor we don't need.
Yes, we do.
It's unproven.
No, it isn't. Of course there was a planet. Because of the trajectories of all the debris that Van Flandern, as the celestial mechanics expert of the solar system, when he was employed by the Naval Observatory, calculated, that led him to the idea that there was an exploded planet to begin with. Because the orbits of those things are not, they're not what nature would have created. They're what an artificial problem would have created, a la an ancient conflict of some kind that literally used planets as bowling balls. Remember, artificially advanced technology, and if we're dealing with a dome around the moon, it's pretty
advanced. No, you can't use inscrutable as an excuse.
No, I can use incredibly advanced beyond anything you or I know how to do.
That doesn't explain. That doesn't automatically mean that therefore they contain an explanation. It just means when you don't understand some particular force, it doesn't mean that you can't use that as an explanation for something else that you can't explain.
Look, I think this is a premature conversation because you and I do not.
Why?
Because we don't have access to the damn libraries. Talking about how it got there and what its purpose was and all that is arm waving. The only thing I will stand behind.
Hypothetical.
It is real. It is. I don't want to speculate. I want real data. I did not have you come on.
Sounds like you want a strong arm.
No, I want you to come up with an alternative for a dome around the moon to explain what we're seeing, if you can. And I don't think you can.
Well, I don't think there was one. I think there was an awful lot of glass structure there, but not the dome. If the dome was there, I do have a model. But the model doesn't fit yours. It means that it came that way, that in another circumstance, in another environment, whether it was out in the Oort cloud or thousands of light years away and it got transported here, for whatever purpose they needed. And I think it was a bigger structural need than it just happened to be the right size. And maybe it was available. So it may have an entire civilization, which you've alluded to occasionally. It might have had an entire civilization or three.
But why is this a useful speculation? I can create any wild idea you can imagine for where this thing came from and why it had a dome before they moved it here. It's pointless. It's stupid because we don't know and we're not going to find out till we find the light.
Well, they didn't build it after it got here.
Saying they did.
Okay.
We are in agreement. The dome that I'm seeing was probably put around the original moon, wherever it used to orbit, in whatever solar system amenable to whatever intelligent forces of, you know, consciousness that existed in that system. And either it was borrowed because it wasn't needed anymore, or it was abandoned. Remember, it's a big galaxy, Mr. Scott. And as to the reasons of why, rather than waste pointless airtime and trying to speculate as to why, let's just go and find the damn libraries, and it's probably on page 10,034. The moon came with a dome.
There is such catalog of useful facts. It probably is in there.
Librarians love to archive everything. Everything. So it's in there somewhere. The problem is, how do we translate it? We have to back engineer what Nova's done for his archives on the moon. Right?
I almost mentioned, right. Now, this is not about the moon. Give me a second here. I almost mentioned this somewhere else recently that my father had some old school books. I remember he was, because of my odd...
You mean like McGuffey's Reader?
Older than that.
Oh, my God.
I mean, I've still got a couple of them.
So do I.
19th century,
exactly. You can say.
One of them is a world geography. And this was, at the time, a higher-level textbook. Right. And there's a section in there that I just love to pieces. And it was describing the flora and fauna of the area of Egypt.
Mm.
And it said one of the perils there which can range to be 40 feet or more in length and can lift a boat from the water and swallow its occupant, known as the Great Snake of the Desert. And in other words, they had sandworms.
Sounds like Dune, yeah.
Yeah, they had sandworms in a 19th century textbook, and it was written as fact. Now, where did it come from? It didn't even, I don't think that even came from Herodotus.
Why is this relevant to an ancient dome around the moon?
Because this stuff sneaks into all sorts.
No, it doesn't. This is data. Forget the stories. We have data. Just look at the damn data. Don't try to explain it. Just look at
okay,
it.
Okay, what data? Okay, what?
The dome.
What?
Look at number
the dome,
10.
The dome is not an observable. As an observable, that's not data.
Andrew.
What you observe is that there's something there.
Why is Ron spouting nonsense? Of course it's observable data. Everything we observe is observable data. And we're at the top of the hour, so I don't want to miss another break, okay? So let me let my participants kind of, you know, gird their loins or do whatever else people who disagree pleasantly do. You know, we're at the top of the hour. What I'm going to do here is try to find something appropriate to where we are, because this is really interesting now. We have a dome. We don't know why it was built. We don't know when it was built. We don't know who built it. All I can say is it was obviously someone who knew a lot more than we know, with technology far beyond, you know, the ken of mortal men, according to Superman used to go. And I have no problem with that, because I have been expecting, once we reach out there and find really interesting ET alien stuff, it's going to be on the surface almost incomprehensible. Remember, Arthur, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. We're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return.
TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com. Talk radio with pictures on demand. Liberate your hyperdimensional time scale and non-linearly access over 400 hours of conversation at the cutting edge of science and thought. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive content that fits your interests and time schedule. Filter episodes by guest or subject. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Listen while you travel or as an environment to your endeavors. 8 cents an episode, 2.5 cents per hour of content. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone, on this now Saturday night, grading into Sunday morning, the 24th of March, here in 2024. My guests this morning are Ranjur Braun, and we've got Ruggiero Kahlo waiting in the wings. I want to come back to you, Andrew, because, you know, this can go on and on and on forever. Ron has agreed there's a dome, but we disagree as to details. But that's pointless because, of course, we're going to disagree as to details. The only data we have is what we see in these images, and there's more than one set of images from two separate cameras. There's people on Earth. There's Apollo. There is so much evidence for the existence of this structure. I want to get into now what you and I have discussed, you know, offline for, you know, many, many weeks, which is why all the secrecy? Why don't they just admit what's there? Andrew, you want to break the news?
Yeah. Well, I did want to update you on Michael's investigations really quick, if I can. He went to Corey Schmitz's site, I guess it was some, and he increased the, you know, contrast gain and all that, and he found a dome.
Amazing! God, what is, well, you know, science, it really, when you need it, it really comes through. I'm being very facetious.
Yeah. Well, it goes back to what you said, Richard. It depends on your sources, right? And obviously Schmidt has, he's not manipulating the data that's...
No, he's just putting it out there. And I bet you he does not have the faintest idea of what his images have captured.
Yeah.
Not a clue.
But Richard, on the topic of, like, why are they trying to bottle it up? You know, I was listening to Dark Journalist. I think it might have been his episode yesterday. He has something, I think, every Friday. That's Daniel Litz. I don't know why he doesn't bring you on his show, but anyways, talks about you. Whenever Joseph gets on his show, he talks about you constantly, but for some reason he never reaches out to you. But one of the things that he kept repeating, because he's been, interestingly enough, doing a lot of shows on, you know, the deep state, of course, and whatever that is, and, you know, the whole, well, and the whole space impetus, right? Like the whole focus. And he, you know, and he goes extensively into Kennedy and how Kennedy was making moves back in the 60s that, you know, are even baffling today. Like, he was ahead of the game by so much because of what he may have known from the inside about what was on the moon. Because as we've talked, or as you've talked about, you know, Kennedy wanted to do a joint venture to the moon with the Russians, right? Anyways, one of the things that Daniel said is that he kept repeating how it looks more and more like space, solar system, our local space, is going to be reserved for government and commercial enterprise and, you know, basically big companies, oligarchs. And I'm like thinking to myself, okay, so here we go again, Richard. We're going to have little railways going out. So that would be equivalent to, you know, NASA, some other space agencies, and everybody's pretty tightly controlled. And then you're going to have the robber barons, those wonderful 19th century folks, bankers, industrialists who had some unethical ways of doing things. And they're going to basically control those railway lines and where those railway lines go to. And it's, yeah, and the treasure's there, just like you said. I mean, if this is brought to light, this dome.
What do you mean if? See, well, at some point it has to be. You know why? See, you didn't say the magic word.
When?
The reason for the cover-up. It's one word, and it solves
greed.
Every mystery. Exactly. It's all about greed. Think
so
oligarch. Think, you know, the think Musk, think the Russians, think the Saudis, think Trump. I mean, the reason, obviously, why Trump didn't do anything with the data on the moon we gave him is because he's been figuring out for the last several years how he can make a buck on it. And he's in the catbird seat of making a huge. How much is what we have talked about tonight worth in hard currency? Let's get very practical here. If I'm right, if I was right back in 1996 and am now right tonight, and the moon is filled with ancient, not only architecture, but technologies that we can only dream about, ranging from immortality, You heard me right. Biological immortality. Remember the Chinese goddess of the moon and her little jade rabbit? And what's the little rabbit doing when he accompanies her to the moon in the Chinese mythology? He's working with mortar and pestle on the secrets of the elixir of life and immortality. Plus anti-gravity. What holds this damn dome up? Why is it still above the surface as opposed to lying all over the surface like an ancient collapsed circus tent? Because whatever technology was used to build it, it's still in operation. And when I say technology, I don't mean active electrics and stuff like that. I'm talking the materials themselves, the glasses, the supports, whatever in intricate, incredible, smart architecture went into this multi-layered, amazing, glittering structure all over the moon, 15 million square miles. I mean, what's the volume? Well, raise it up 20 miles and then do another calculation. The volume of this is more than every living space on Earth, then some, because you're living in a 3D reality. What if whoever built this thing knew how to control gravity so every one of those cubicles, every dining room, every whatever, could have whatever gravity or environment that the occupant chose? In other words, the endless list of technological radical breakthroughs less than a quarter million miles away, available to any oligarch with money to build a spacecraft and go to the moon and bring it back and make a million copies and sell it to consumers all over the... In other words, what we have here, visible at night, is a beautiful full moon full of gold and treasure and uncountable wealth for... there and stakes a claim that they can support with technology that lets them go to and from. And at the moment, there's only
a map.
Exactly. That's what we need, but we need the libraries. Now,
so
go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. After you,
I think Ron kind of nailed it. So, Richard, there was remember, Curry, what you're going to say, and then backlight it with this. That was a note to self. Back in early December of the last year, an article came out in space.com talking about DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. And we know they just do all kinds of covert, you know, three-letter agents. Well, they're not.
They just quietly backed Barry 1, which, by the way, is still doing weird things in orbit. And nobody
right.
wants to talk about it. Nobody. Wants to talk about.
Well, apparently working with 14 companies. These are mostly American, some international, kind of larger ones, smaller ones, as part of a 10-year lunar architecture capability study, they call it. It's called Luna 10. And I'll just read here. The study is meant to make significant progress in the development of future lunar habitats. The goal? Self-sustaining, monetizing, commercially owned and operated lunar infrastructure. Now, let me read you all 14 of the companies. Blue Origin, Cislunar Industries. So some of these I haven't looked up yet.
Well, Lunar Origin is Blue Origin is Bezos.
Right. Cislunar Industries. Crescent, stop me if you want to talk about it. Crescent Space Services, LLC. FiberTech Inc., Firefly Aerospace. That's an interesting name.
Sure is. Love the movie.
Yeah, Geet AI. Sure. Anyways, GITAI. Helios, Honeybee Robotics. Well, there's an interesting name.
Yeah, they've been heavily involved in the JPL missions to Mars and building the robots on the arm to do the drilling and the sweeping and all that.
Right. Icon, some company called Icon, Nokia of America, Northrop Grumman, Red Wire Corporation, Sierra Space, and of course SpaceX. And
it's kind of like a who's who of who's behind the current global private initiative space program.
So now back to note to self, I put a little yellow sticky note in my brain. You just said it. You and Ron just said it. We need it. We need to know where these places are that have libraries, or these places, these hubs that, you know, that must be, you know, around. You know, Richard, it's really interesting. I stumbled across the 1974 series. I watched it when I was really a little kid. A Planet of the Apes. It was a 14 episode. Well, they ran one season only on CBS. And it was basically a takeoff from the ape movies. They had, you know, the Planet of the Ape movies. They had been so successful, they tried to develop a TV series. And what's really interesting is that sort of dotted through the 14 episodes, and I hit the third one, is they start to kind of find these little caches in the ruined cities where they restart these computers, mm-hmm. and holographic projections of the scientists start to talk about where to find the information of these cities, or of the technology of the Earth. Because remember, this is a future Earth. There's been a World War III thermonuclear disaster. Everything's destroyed. The apes have taken over. But in this TV series, the two astronauts with Galen, the chimpanzee, Roddy McDowell, they find these caches. You know, it's literally like what we've been talking about. It's the same thing. And it's funny, you know, do you know, it was Planet of the Apes that bumped away Roddenberry's, was it Genesis 2? It was bumped aside in favor of Planet of the Apes, and then it just became too expensive. But my point is that this is the concept they were revolving around, was this idea that there were these, and, you know, they were trying to basically put a puzzle together. So is that what we need, is to have the insight to? I think it was cool.
Well, there's been a whole bunch of those, so I know. I just wondered which one you meant. It.
Roddenberry was going to have a show called Genesis 2 in, I guess, 1973 or something, and it never. It was bumped aside by
on CBS.
Well, he did a pilot,
right?
And actually, there was another TV series that was on for a while. I don't remember the name of it, but it was that same theme.
Planet Earth.
I don't know. I don't remember the name. Memory fails. So,
but anyways, let's not derail Andrew's.
Well, it's just that, you know, is the key now, because, like, you know, unless, like you said, unless we have billions of dollars, or we have some sort of secret army, or we're like, you know, I don't know, the evil James Bond villain guy, you know, we don't have a lot of power. I mean, like do more work to find the maps, to find these places, and then we have leverage. Now we can stake a claim. I mean, I'm not sure what it takes to push humanity forward.
This is why we need to find the right space lawyer, and I'm going to devote some time in the coming couple of weeks to do that, because I don't think space law, as it's currently conceived, imagines for a nanosecond what's waiting on the moon that's commercially saleable, that will have a huge global market among 7 billion human beings who kind of need almost everything. I mean, whoever lands and gets the right claim and has access, physical access, is going to own the world.
Well, Richard, here's another thing. We've seen, apparently sent into the Pacific, was it Atlantic or Pacific?
Pacific.
It was sent to one Pacific. And it was carrying human DNA, the crew members of the Starship Enterprise or Star Trek, and, you know, other goodies. And now we see with this Intuitive Machines landing, like a whole cache of not only experiments, but like human statements, artwork,
art project, you know, yeah,
books, your book.
Well, yeah, my book is on the moon now twice, at least in terms of this one. We know where to find it. We know exactly where it is. It's sitting there tilted to hell with the
Gutenberg Bible. Or
well, no, it's also there. It's also there.
No, but is
Ron, are you jealous?
No.
Good. No. Continuing.
No, but I did want to point out that when I said treasure map, you guys are way ahead of me. I have no problem with what you're saying. That's why I wasn't saying anything. By treasure map, I meant in the sense of the one that gets you past all the perils. And the perils in this case would be your dome.
Getting down through the glass. Well,
you know
how you can land safely on the moon? JPL, I hope you're listening. as Trump said about the Russians. I hope you're listening. Get rid of the lasers. Lasers and glass don't mix. And image map, terrain mapping does not mix because images coming through the glass are distorted. That's why you landed at three times your velocity, because your spacecraft thought in the computer that it was imaging a surface that was farther away than it really was. So you need to go back to radar. Remember, surveyors landed with S-band radar, and they landed 5 out of 7 tries. That's not bad for stone knives and bearskins. So ditch all the, you know, sexy lasers and all that, and go back to the basics that the NASA used when they set these surveyors down, can land anywhere on the moon.
It works.
That you, exactly. Why they're trying to reinvent the wheel, well, because they don't know any better. They don't know that there's a dome. They don't know that lasers are bad with glass, and they obviously are
going
to
They don't want to know. It's the greedy rich.
No.
They make money.
No, they're not going to make any money unless they can get down safely and find the library. Now, let me tell you why everybody is suddenly going to the South Pole, because that's where the library, or more than one, are. And I think there may be ancient texts or documents for the in crowd. Can you say, you know, secret society? And since we know that NASA is a ritual-based organization, we know that they probably have searched the world for terrestrial copies of the treasure map, Ron, and they may know exactly where the good stuff is, particularly starting with the libraries. If you get the libraries, you will find the map to everything else on the moon that's of value, because we are not the first. I don't know what number we are, but we're way, way down the line in a solar system of billions of years that we are not the first. There's no way we are the first.
So, Richard, I want to just tie up my point. I know Ruggiero needs to come on here because I'm looking at the clock and I can't believe how fast it is. But I believe there's more to this idea of putting human stuff on the moon, you know, books, artwork, poetry, music, whatever, you name it. I just don't believe, like Noah was saying, oh, no, it's just to preserve for the future. I think there's something else going on. I don't know how we've talked about this. I still have to talk to Tim about this, about salvaging, about salvage rights, maybe even squatters' rights. Like, what does it take to...
Well, Ron used to own a piece of the moon. Ron, you want to talk about it?
Yes. I used to be a credentialed landholder of the of a piece of the lunar surface, and... Then they instituted the treaty back in the...
1967. Yeah, January 67.
No, this was earlier than that, what happened to me happened, because this had all transpired in the late 50s, and then the first iteration of such things involved the fact that they had to make sure that there were no private owners, ownership of the moon, because they had to expect that to happen, but it had gotten through. You know, because they said nobody paid any serious attention to the paperwork, but Ralston Purina had done it correctly. And so they had to track down every single deed that had been purchased. And we did have to pay for it through the, it was only $1 a square foot, but, you know, what the heck.
Well, back then, a dollar was a dollar.
Yeah, exactly. However, the point is they had to take it all, they had to buy it all back. In order for the lawyers to be happy. Yeah, that's, unfortunately, that's as far as that goes. I wish I knew where it was.
Well, we can probably find out if we get the right space lawyer, because they will have done all their due diligence going back to the first Pan Am selling tickets and Walt Disney. Remember the trip to the moon? There was an actual certificate that you could, you know, fly to the moon someday if you bought a ticket through Disney. I mean,
you're right. I thought about that. You're right. There's a filing cabinet somewhere that has all that in it.
Yep.
You guys,
go ahead.
Well, here's another angle.
You can't be, you know, shy on this show. You must be aggressive.
I'll try to make this really quick, because, you know, we're trying to figure out how you stake a claim. How do you How do you get that gold rush? How do you come, you know, find your gold and run into the little local town and say, I just want to stake my claim to the, you know, whatever.
Well, remember, the Outer Space Treaty, which was signed in the Lyndon Johnson White House in January of 1967, which literally was the same night that Apollo 1 burned up, the fire that killed three astronauts, that same night, that treaty only applies, it turns out, to government. It does not apply to private citizens or companies or corporations. So some eagle beagle somewhere may have figured out that if Intuitive Machines, as a private U.S. corporation, lands its own spacecraft on the moon and carries whatever, that provides a bounded lunar surface claim, legal, that will stand up in the world court, that they now can claim that piece of real estate to develop any way they want to.
Okay, and on top of that, Richard, though, you have yourself twice now with your books on the moon. Are we moving potentially to the level of intellectual property? Let me just give you an example of this. So in Canada, there was, and I'm sure this applies, like I would think in most sensible Western countries, at least, I mean, because I'm thinking of the West and Canada in particular. There was way back, I believe it was in the early 80s, might have been earlier than that. There was a sculptor named Michael Snow, and he did a series of Canada geese, like sculptures, that were hung from the Eaton Center in Toronto.
Hmm.
And it was beautiful, apparently. It was just like, you know, it was a very early 80s. I can't remember the particular year. Anyways, Eaton's decided during the Christmas holidays to basically hang garland on the geese. And Michael, I believe it was Michael Snow, he found it, or he came in and saw it and demanded that Eaton's take it down. They said, what are you talking about? We own it. We own your artwork. We own the land. He said, no. You own the right to show my artwork. You don't own how the artwork is presented. Anyways, went into this whole case, and he won.
Oh.
They had to take it down, and it set a precedence. Now, here's my point. If human artistry or creativity finds its way into the solar system, is that a letter of notice? Is that an intellectual point? And even more, if someone like yourself and Kinthea, who rang the bell for the face on Mars, or Ron, who was discussing how to find relics on Kinthea's show last night, if you see it first, measure it first, you identify it first, do you have some sort of intellectual stake in it?
You mean like an 1849 gold claim?
Yeah, like I don't know. I mean, these are questions.
We need a space lawyer, the right space lawyer. So if anybody out there in the audience either is one or knows one, please get hold of us. And I'm going to obviously say again.
The space, if you have a lawyer hidden in your basement, yeah, let him out and then let him.
Is Ron Gerbron famous sense of humor? Because I'm trying to be a little serious. There's a lot of money at stake here.
And, oh, I'm very serious. I'm very serious about this. The maritime law is what applies so far.
Maritime or is it admiralty? There's a difference.
Well, there might be, but...
Well, no. That's why there is a gold fringe around every U.S. flag. Everyone,
yeah,
why there are gold fringes, it has to do with admiralty law, and I don't know the exegesis enough to know what it means, but it doesn't mean that a naked flag and a gold flag are the same. One outranks the other with a whole bunch of legal precedent that I have no idea what the details are, but somebody has established that every single flag displayed, including the flags on the astronauts' shoulders, have little gold braid around them. That means something legally.
Yes.
Legally. Yeah, we need to find out what that something means.
Well, admiralty or maritime law, as far as I know, maybe admiralty is the appropriate term, whichever one it is that applies, applies to things that we haven't, that you haven't got yet. And it's like, that's the...
Wait. Like what?
Let me try to explain to you. If you're an explorer and you find something, you can, you have through that a priority claim based on that. If nobody else can ever find it again, you know, it just, which has happened, it goes away. But it then has to be balanced against territorial claims made by governments. You know, I'm not the lawyer here, but this is the way the structure of those things work. They talked about it actually briefly in that story, The Martian. They ended up as the Matt Damon movie. Boy, he declares himself king of Mars. He had a lot of time on his hands, stranded up there, and he looked through those kinds of legal things, and he discovered that if you go somewhere, settle, and grow crops, and this was an ancient standard that goes back to Viking times, if you go somewhere, you set...
Andrew and I are having the same thought.
Go, Richard.
Yeah, we're having... No, you go.
Oh, yes. Chinese broccoli.
Yes! Yeah. When the Chinese landed Chang whatever on the far side of the moon, they had a little experiment, a little incubator, where they grew lettuce and something else, and someone at the time said, this is prerequisite legally for homesteading.
Yeah, boy. Yes. They've been trying to do that quietly all along. We own the moon. Thank you very much.
By the way, it's 2 minutes to the break, you guys, and we do have to bring Ruggiero on.
Yeah, we're going to bring him on right after the break because he's got an amazing story to tell that will fit into this. So, okay, Taylor, why don't we stop here? Because we are literally at the bottom of the hour. My guests this morning, Ron Gerbron, Andrew Curry, Ruggiero Kahlo is coming on. And I can't not do this show tonight without ending with Karen Carpenter. Let me see if this is working. Oh, here we are.
Upon the recitation and we're about to stay. Calling occupants of the two planetaries. Calling the occupants of interplanetary most extraordinary craft.
Problem is, suppose on Earth we don't own the moon. Suppose all our legalisms are pointless because, as Charles Fort said, we are someone's property in some galactic legal whatever. You see where this can go? You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return.
TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Support the broadcaster to provide you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com.
Folks, just want to take a moment, as it is put, on a single gun with George Gibbet.
Okay, that is not going to work. I've got two tangled circuits. Well, that never works. Ruggiero Kahlo is an artist. He is a doctor. He has an incredible eye, and he has made a really fascinating discovery. So without further ado, Ruggiero, do you have your Earl Grey tea, and can you tell us the amazing thing you have found?
Good morning, Richard. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Really enjoyed listening. Rich, good morning. A bit cold here in the UK, although I really enjoyed listening to the show this morning.
Well, before you get into your discovery, which is pretty cool, what are your thoughts on what we talked about for the last couple hours?
Where do I start? I got a question I'll start with, actually. When we look at all the space missions, every time we look at a planet that's been photographed from one of the orbiting spaceships, we should see a dome around or a flare around every photograph, and see like Jupiter or Saturn or any other moons or asteroid structures. But from my memory, we don't. So we're seeing something quite unique.
Wait. I don't think I understand you. What do you mean we should see something around them?
Camera flare, Richard, is what I'm getting at. When we're taking pictures in space, right?
Yeah.
And if we get back to the moon, to the dome, when we take a picture of the moon from afar, when you bring up the resolution, you see the halo around the outside. And I'm sure we don't see that on every picture, do we?
Well, because in order to get lens flare, you got to have an overwhelmingly bright image, you know, and you have to have the wrong geometry. And, you know, basically what gives you sun flares is the sun. You know, planets are just too dim to give you that overwhelming brightness unless you overwhelmingly overexpose the image, in which case you don't see anything.
Good point. But I think that sort of compare and contrast, what I was going with, is a way to, you know, look at the evidence to help part of the picture to explore what's going on. But what do I think of tonight? I think, you know, how it's been presented and the few stuff discussed are outstanding. Particularly what really got me was the curvature of the lines that we're seeing through, the cuddled background lines we're seeing through.
Well, here's the reason as an artist it captivates you, because with a 180-degree wide-angle fisheye lens, the stuff is all curved if it's linear. If it's not curved, if it's linear in a 180 image, it means the original is curved. Sunbeams don't curve. Lens flares don't curve. That's how we know this is real stuff and not a trick of light and shadow.
Yeah, and the colors, they get me every time. As I'm being colors that we see.
Can you imagine seeing this with your own eyeballs? And it's moving, because if you even move like a foot or two, the sparkles, the refraction, the prisms, the glare, everything will change dramatically with even a few footsteps. So can you imagine the Artemis astronauts, because everybody wants to go to the South Pole of the moon now, and they open their faceplates and they look up through the clear plastic and they see all this stuff. How can they deny what they're going to see with their own unaided eyes, because it's that dense over the poles?
That'd just be spectacular to be there. But it won't be me, I'm afraid, you know, but I would.
Well, wait. If we find anti-gravity on the moon, if we find the technology for producing real spaceships, which I absolutely think is sitting there, it means that anybody can go to space in an anti-gravity real spaceship. No G-forces, no rockets, no fumes, no special training. It's basically getting on an airline and landing where you want, which is at the South Pole of the moon. So don't count out that you will not see this physically someday, Ruggiero, because you can. If we do what we need to do, you will be able politically to go and stand under this incredible canopy and ask this obvious question, who the hell did this and why?
That's a big question. You know what, Richard, slightly sidetracking. It's been all over the British papers and the internet at the moment. But the Brits are really worried that because we're going to have helicopter drone taxis within 2 years.
Right.
In the UK. Now, I never would have expected I would see that in my lifetime because of the implications and the difficulties of giving a bunch of Brits a load of helicopters to fly around. You know, you know, we're like a bunch of rabble.
Well, it's all right because there'll be an AI running them. Mm. It will not be British pilots.
But my point is that technology has come on so fast, so soon. You know, the US government were working with the Australians, I think, to try and produce some kind of a military field operational drone motorbike back in around 2014. And we've heard nothing since. And suddenly we've got taxis that are going to be on our streets within 2 years, you know, AI operated. So what, when we see this in the foreground, what's going on in the background we're not privy to? That's, you know, that's a big question. And who allowed your book to go onto the moon twice, Richard? You know, that's it.
Actually, Andrew raised that. You raised that question a few weeks ago. You said, how come your book made it to the moon twice? And I said, well, it's part of Wikipedia. It's obviously somebody put everything on the web. So, you know, they just copied everything off Wiki to put on the moon. But I wound up there twice because, you know, the book is out. It's published. It was actually a bestseller, both of them.
I think it's great, but that's the equivalent to Zahi Hawass doing a grand reopening of the Cairo Museum and putting a copy of Brian Forrester and engineer Christopher Dunn's books straight in the central library.
Would that be interesting? Yeah.
The Cairo Museum has the centerpiece.
Precisely.
Discussion. That's how important putting your book is on the moon. And I think one on the bottom of the sea, is that right?
Well, there is one now.
There is. Yeah. So, yeah, point is, what's going on in the background is not obviously what we're always privy to, hence the taxis. So my discovery, yeah?
Yes.
Right, I think that you're alluding to my image number 10.2. Would that be right?
Let me go look. I'm having a problem with, 10.1 and 10.2. No, actually, not 10.2. It's 10.1. Oh, and you didn't do it. Oh, you didn't do it.
What was it?
It's the Rollins.
Oh no, Keith hasn't put them up, or they're not appearing unless I need to refresh.
Okay, let me refresh.
I might have to ask Keith to.
Well, we may have to do that for another show because we don't have a lot of time, you know. So obviously we need to do more than just a few minutes. Number two, you understand what you're seeing in number two, right? First of all, let me give you some context. The last two images, 10.1 and 10.2, in Ruggiero's section, are IO photographed close-up by a recent two Juno flybys of the current unmanned NASA spacecraft, which has been orbiting the moon, orbiting Mars, Jupiter. Got to get my orientation in the solar system for several years, and it's lasted way longer than it was supposed to. So you have zoomed in literally on 10.2 to that very bright thing extending beyond the limb of Io. And obviously you're asking, what is it, right?
Certainly am.
It's not a dome. Absolutely, okay. It is not a dome. But I know what it is because Io has hundreds of belching volcanoes which are spewing sulfur and other primordial gases from the Io mantle as dredged up by the energy of tidal needing from it orbiting Jupiter. And what you're seeing is the diffuse sulfate particles of sulfur in the thin atmosphere of Io that are hanging like aerosols, like droplets, like smog over Los Angeles, all over the surface of Io. as an atmosphere of basically sulfur dioxide.
Right.
It's like a dome, because a dome of the same geometry will scatter light the same way. So unless you knew the chemistry, you'd be very, you know, obvious in thinking maybe this is another dome around Io. It is not. It is an atmosphere.
Okay, that's what I was thinking.
How did I know that's what you were thinking?
for obvious reasons. I guess with the discussion with that and the moon, because you've got real substance there, we then go and compare the photographs of the moon. And because the moon has no atmosphere, we shouldn't see.
No, of course not. It should be what they call a hard vacuum. In fact, an old industrial friend of mine, his name was Neil Rusick, and he was with, I forget what firm he'd created, but he was looking way back in the Apollo era, because we had him as a guest on our Apollo 11 CBS shows. He wrote a book about industrial usage of the moon called Where the Winds Are All Asleep, because there's no atmosphere, so there's no wind. So you could do all kinds of really cool engineering, chemistry, and industrial things on the moon, according to Neil's book. Problem is, if this dome is now around the moon, all of those ideas will have to be recalibrated and rethought, because most of the moon is probably going to be argued legally as out of bounds when the courts and civilization realizes there is a multi-trillion-dollar treasure, literally a quarter million miles away, and it's all going to be open season for whoever can get there and stake a claim. So does that bring the conversation back to what Intuitive Machines is doing, Andrew? Are they laying the foundation, as the lawyers love to claim, for claiming prospecting sites on the moon?
That's my impression, Richard. I just don't buy all this. I was going to discuss some the sort of fight between these living, very well-heeled.
No, boring.
Right. But just the fact that they're bringing all this human baggage on board, I'm sorry, it's not just some little symbolic thing. This is something more, in my opinion. I'm not a legal expert. I don't know how these things work, but there's got to be something about you know, like the plants, right?
Exactly. No. Ron was absolutely right. The Chinese have tried to homestead the moon and file a legal claim for down the road.
Right, but there might be something equivalent here in terms of if you put your column down with your inscriptions on it, in other words, your culture, that you may be able to plant.
We need that space lawyer. If there's anybody in the audience who either is one or knows one, or as Ron said, has one hiding in their basement, please introduce them to us, call us, email us. I want to do a show on who owns what's there, because what's there could buy the human race 1,000 times over. And I'm not exaggerating.
No.
What would a workable anti-gravity technology be worth in the open market around Earth today? Think of how much energy goes into transporting things, stuff. We learned during COVID, you know, a new word. Most stuff on Earth moves around the Earth on an equipotential surface called the ocean. Not really under gravity, but kind of midway between zero gravity and some, because the fuel is used to move across the ocean, not to lift yourself up into the sky, which is very energy intensive. Can you imagine if functional anti-gravity was discovered either holding the dome up or as part of a separate set of technologies that is sitting in some garage somewhere? And we back engineer it and we manufacture it, or someone does, and then, like Ford, markets it to everybody on the planet who wants their own Jetson sky car talk about taxis in Britain, Ruggiero, and helicopters and drones, you know, be the limit. And the price of manufacturing anywhere on Earth and then bringing those products back to the United States or to England or Russia or whatever drops from dollars to pennies to transport anything from anywhere to anywhere on Earth's surface. That one engineering scientific technology alone would radically make everybody on Earth immensely richer, because your dollar or your ruble or your kronen or whatever would have so much more purchasing power if the cost of bringing goods from Australia was like bringing it from the next town over in this new era. One breakthrough like that.
But we also break away from the hold on energy. I mean, we're not going to be reliant on the oligarchs anymore, like on these big companies, on DARPA trying to hide everything. I mean, one of the big issues Joseph and Daniel Litz, dark journalist, talk about, Richard, is that Daniel, that there has been basically what he calls the X technology, right? And we see this sort of X symbology used over and over and over again through human history.
You mean
and
like
that,
Musk?
Exactly.
There's a whole backstory, by the way, why he changed Twitter to X, and I lost it. I had it in my inbox, and I lost it. I got to go find it again. But somebody did a deep dive into why suddenly Musk is championing X. There's a story there, a real story.
Well, and that's the thing. And Daniel talks about it. He says that literally it's been this association of secret societies. I mean, Manly P. Hall, that Georgia sort of follows, is one of these characters. And that it is these groups that have shepherded the knowledge, the anti-gravity zero point, through time. And that, you know, there is now a pull that one part of the secret society, the right-handed side, wants to reintroduce it to humanity. And then there's the left-handed side, a little darker, that are saying, no, we're going to keep it to ourselves. And that's their model. That's his model. And, you know, I think there's something to it. So if we get back into the solar system, find those, you know, get the map to the treasure, which is the libraries, and we unlock it.
Don't you think the inside guys already have that?
Well, I'm back to what Ron says, and Ron should come in quick, is that these secret societies, these sort of, you know, their deep state people, whatever, have kind of forgotten what it is that they were supposed to be protecting in the first place. Like, there's
sure?
that.
I'm not sure about that at all.
Ron, are you there? Oh. Yeah, I'm here. Remember, you said that. You said they may not even really know what it is they're protecting anymore.
Right. I believe I lifted that from that Texan that knew so much, Jim Mars. He said the real inner secret of the Illuminati is that they've forgotten what the real secret is.
That's his opinion. Again, data, please. I think they know exactly what they're doing.
Wait, Richard. No. That's always a fair response, except in this case, how could you possibly know something that has been lost?
Because it hasn't been lost. It's been passed down as a sacred document back to our model, a piece of the
act. Meaning that people still know it.
Some do.
That.
Some do.
Some do.
Only a tiny, tiny handful. Everybody else are just worker bees. They do whatever they're told. They're paid very well to not ask questions. I mean, one of the things that Andrew and I speculated about was the way that we get all the JPL people to not talk about artifacts on Mars,
right?
One of Ron's favorite places, and all the stuff that he's seen and I've seen and a whole bunch of other people have seen. How can all these incredible genius-level worker bees at JPL looking at these images hot off the press day after day after day after day not see what's there and not open their mouths and not call press conferences and not blow the whistle? And the answer that Andrew and I came up with is, Andrew, go ahead.
They're going to get a piece of the action.
Exactly. They've been bought off. I mean, look, there are two ways you can get people to keep quiet. One is to threaten them, bodily harm. If you talk, remember the guy in Roswell who said to one of the witnesses, "It's a damn big desert, ma'am. They'd never find you." And she reported that years later when she was, you know, got tired of shaking. Because it was true. Back in those days, you could disappear and they couldn't do a thing to you. Well, that threat in an era of social media probably breaks down pretty quickly because people talk, particularly on social media. They talk. I've been threatened and I've talked. I've talked about it on Art, talked about it on George, talked about it on this show, talked about it in the Wall Street Journal, talked about it everywhere. Because the more you make it visible, the less the threat is effective. A much more effective threat is not a threat at all. It's a candy cane. It's an incredible lure. We know you know there's stuff out there. And you sign this document, which is an NDA, you will get a piece of the action when we get to that part of the plan. And I guarantee you, everybody will shut up because who does not want to be wealthy enough to own a whole planet at some point.
Okay. We're not quite there yet, I don't think.
Yeah, but you don't have to be. All you have to do is work for an organization which makes the impossible possible day after tomorrow. And now we've got private players. We've got, you know, Elon. We've got Bezos. We've got Russian oligarchs who are here who are doing, you know, major interesting things like the so-called Breakthrough Listen Project and the Breakthrough Starshot Project. They're all lining up to be in the catbird seat to when, I mean, why do you think Musk is working so hard to develop a technology which is almost available at a ticket price to anybody to certainly go to the moon? What if his whole thing about Mars is all a false trail? Because he knows what's on the moon, and he's going to put nine artists in orbit. Nine artists, Andrew. Are their sketches going to be the claim by Musk and company of what's there?
Mm.
Will legally stand up? If they
with witnesses.
If they take photographs, images, they send it over X live, they broadcast from lunar orbit. Oh, my God, look at this, and the sun is just right. And the rainbows are coruscating. I mean, it would be an impossible to deny show broadcast all over the world. And Musk might own what they photograph.
Yeah. Nine witnesses.
What's the point of putting a bunch of artists on a spaceship to just go and have a look at a great moon?
Because the artists will see it first.
Of course.
Artists will see it first, right, Andrew?
Yeah, no, and they're witnesses, and they're expert witnesses, and yeah.
And they each have huge followings.
Yeah, and I mean, I hate to say it, Richard, but it comes back to that childhood adage, I saw it first, it's mine.
Exactly. See, in the world that I grew up in, where I, you know, write books and all that, writing about something, having an idea, you cannot copyright ideas. You can only copyright products that are from those ideas, like a specific work. At least that's my limited knowledge of copyright on Earth. How it works under the Outer Space Treaty of 67, which may have fine print that no one has read because no one thought it would ever come to pass, and they had no idea when they put it together as to what was waiting at the end of the rainbow.
Or they were smart enough to be more open-ended, Richard. Hey, one real quick note, and I know we're getting close to the end of the show. When you're talking about these NDAs and employees working, one of the big things they often do with these employees is give them shares.
Of course.
Yep.
There could be fictitious, well, not fictitious, because they're probably real, and all they do is offer them a contract.
Yep.
And no matter how genius you are at JPL, what incredible lofty ideals we know these people all have, and their imagination and their vision and their attachment to what they're doing, all they have to be told is, if you keep your mouth shut, this is going to be worth a lot of money and it's going to be while you're young enough to enjoy it.
By the way, Richard, Greg Aaron sent out a very interesting article to me, part of that DARPA thing. In preparation for a permanent human colony on the moon, DARPA has awarded a contract to Northrop Grumman to develop a lunar railway concept.
Oh, my. Because you can't land down through the dome. You need Arthur Clarke's monorail, which he formulated in print in 1952 in A Fall of Moondust. Just not here to see it all happen. Hey, we're literally 30 seconds from the end of the show. I want to thank all my guests this morning, Ron Gerbron and Andrew Curry and Ruggiero. Ruggiero, we're going to bring you back in the next couple of weeks. We're going to talk about Io, because wait till you see what I've done with the ruins that you found. So until tomorrow night, where Rick Levine and Georgia Lambert and I are going to talk about the amazing predictive aspects of this coming solar eclipse, I'm going to sign off. Thank you so much for listening. Be aware that this is only the first gambit of a very aggressive move we're now going to be making based on this data. It's time we reveal those who would try to steal the moon. Till tomorrow night, then, remember, same time, same bat channel, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everyone.